floor is yours.
Thank you. I just want to... There's an announcement I want to make in a couple minutes because I know everybody's been hearing about it and talking about it. But I want to just say a couple things before I start, which is I really want to start. I want to thank you, John, for the introduction. And Terry, thank you very much. And John and Tom, thank you for inviting me and letting me come up here. I did start working for NOAA. No, I wasn't the general counsel. I was a lowly staff attorney in 1979, and you know, I've heard about fishery management councils from that day forward, and I've never actually been to a council meeting. So, you know, my team at NOAA Fisheries said, "Yeah, we've got a council meeting for you to go to," and you know, I'm really happy, and I'm actually excited to see what an actual council meeting is like and hear your discussion about these hard decisions that are facing you. You can go to a million briefings. You can read a million briefing memos. You can look at charts on screens. But until you hear the actual people who are involved and affected and in these decisions, it's not the same thing. There's no substitute for I know that it's not the same as being out on the water on the boat, but not ready to do that today. A little bit too cold for my California roots there. But so thank you for letting me be here to observe and introduce myself in person. And let me tell you what I do know so far, which is I am a lawyer, but I'm kind of a recovering lawyer. I've moved out of the legal world after 25 years at the Justice Department into the policy and management world, and so I try very hard not to be a lawyer. We have people like Jean Martin, who I worked with in the 80s, to do that part of the job. I'm also not a fisherman, and I'm not a scientist, so I'm not trying to do any of those jobs. I'm trying to be the leader of this organization, to rely on our important partners like you all and our really competent staff like John and Bill at the Science Center, and to be your advocate in Washington, whether it's on policy matters with NOAA to make sure that NOAA Fisheries has its appropriate place in the organization, or with Department of Congress or on the Hill. We all need to, you know, you guys do that from your perspective, and that's my job is to do it from my perspective, not to do the jobs of people like John, who are very good at what they do. I am not coming with a mind to make huge changes. You guys have been through a lot, and I think have made an amazing amount of progress in helping us rebuild our relationship and our trust with you all and with industry. I see that our organization, as far as I can tell, has been going in the right direction, and I don't see any need to make wholesale changes. So we will be working to move forward together in the areas that we've, you know, identified as being priorities. We're going to continue to work with councils, including this one, to apply adaptive management approaches, support new, more targeted approaches to fisheries, to look for technology advancements, to help ease the burden of data collection, and we'll help them try to share management success stories on FishWatch. We're going to try to do more of all of those good things. The Northeast Science Center is doing its best to produce the best science for us all to rely on. I know that there's been a lot of outreach about how to be more collaborative in our science effort. We have to continue to get past the days where we have our science and your science. It's got to be our science. We've got to work on it together, both in terms of science priorities and how best to get there so that we all have the best science that we all acknowledge and trust. And I think that we're on the right track to do that. So I really want to just underscore that how thankful I am to step into a position with a very capable management team, and the fact that they are recognized as such by my organization and you all during this time that has been so tough for you, I think is a real tribute. So I really want to thank Sam Rauch, who is not here today, but I know he is well known to all of you. I think he did a great job of doing both his J job and this job during a difficult time, and to thank John for his leadership. and also Bill at the Southeast Science Center. I think we have a good team to move forward. I guess I also want to acknowledge something that I knew in general terms, but it's been brought home to me over and over and over at all my briefings, which is the United States should be incredibly proud of its fishing industry and what it's accomplished, both that we are really the leaders in the world for responsible fishing practices, and that we've got an incredible story to tell. We're really important in terms of jobs and coastal communities, and it's a story that we need to get out there, and that even here, where there have been a huge amount of challenges facing the groundfish industry, I should practice saying that here, because I guess I'll have to say it a few times. There have also been a lot of successes. You know, a few years ago, the scallop fishery didn't look that bright, but today the Port of New Bedford is one of the most profitable ports, is the most profitable port in the country. So I know that you in this room and everybody that you speak for and represent, that you have suffered, and you are the ones that have felt the pain over the last few years. You are the ones who make your living on fishing. And so when the pain that's been sort of inflicted to attempt to get stocks to recover has been felt by you all, and I am painfully aware of that, although not as directly as you all. And I want us to continue to work together, work on the science, work on the management practices that will get all of us to a better place on that. And I really want to be part of that team. So speaking of working together on things, I want to just make one announcement and reiterate the other. Two issues. One, this is old news. I guess it was announced on Friday, so that's old news now. That NOAA Fisheries will be able to cover the costs of observer and at-sea monitoring for the groundfish fishery for the upcoming year. And I know that that was not a sure thing, and so that is good news. That will help us get through another year. I can already tell that there's a little bit of danger of being the one that cries wolf, that this is a good year, but no promises about the next year. I think that I'm not going to not going to go through the old saw. I'm sure you've heard it a few times from this guy over here, that there's just, you know, there are a lot of demands on the observer money, and we're never sure what level it's going to be and where we're going to have to put it. So no promises. It's possible that sectors will have to pay for some or all of their portion of at-sea monitoring in the future, but at least we've got a year to think about that. So let me get to the announcement about the disaster funding. I think, as everybody knows, we're grateful to Congress for making available the $75 million in the fiscal year 14 budget bill for half a dozen fishery disasters. We do realize that for many people, no amount of funding will be sufficient to address the full economic impacts of these disasters, but we're hoping that this will help with the immediate needs. The portion of the disaster funding that's relevant to this group is that's attributable to the New England groundfish fishery. And we're pleased to announce that $32.8 million is being allocated to the New England disaster. I know that John and NOAA Fisheries staff will continue to work with the state directors and members of industry to develop plans for how to spend these funds. And I know that John has already, even before the allocation was announced today, has had some meetings with state fishery directors, the industry representatives, and members of Congress to discuss possible ways that the disaster funds could best be used to address your problems, your needs. But now that there's a set amount of money identified, I'm sure that this will become even more focused and immediate. I understand that you've already had some discussions over lunch and that those discussions are going to continue next week. I know there are going to be a lot of questions that we're not going to have the answers to today, but we're now in a position to know, you know, how much money do we have to talk about? How are we best? How are we going to move forward? And I hope that that will be a collaborative process, and look forward to seeing the kinds of wise proposals that I know that this group will generate. So with that, I'm going to stop talking. I'm going to sit and listen. I will make my way to the back of the room to listen and see how you work through some of these thorny issues. So again, thank you very much, Terry. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Eileen, for coming to our meeting today, and I'm going to reiterate the thanks I made to John yesterday to the agency for funding another year of observer funding. It's very much appreciated. We're on the tail end of approving an omnibus habitat that's been 10 years in the making for public comment and initial submission, and. As we joked around last week, I said, I hope that when you leave today that all the rumors you heard about us, you'll find are not true. So
so far, so good. I figure if I can survive sitting in this room I feel like the hard work has been done by everybody sitting at this table and my predecessors. And so I heard a lot about the CCC meeting. All those meetings are tough. And, boy, you guys are like pussycats. So I'm assuming that this meeting is going to go the same way. No, there are a lot of tough issues, and I'm sure that we will continue to disagree from time to time on a lot of aspects. But if we can do that with respect and get some genuine back and forth, that's great.
Well, thanks for being here. We're going to move ahead. Karen, could you put the underlying motion up, please? And we're going out to the audience for comments. Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smolowitz, Fisheries Survival Fund. The favor of this motion. But one point I want to emphasize, I've been emphasizing for the last 15 years, is in this particular area, as Michelle has mentioned, we have to be very careful about the data. And one of the things, if you look at the map that's up, the State Insure Survey in Massachusetts finds very large numbers of Young of the Year cod all the way around the coast, abutting Nantucket Shoals, as far as they're capable of fishing. They use the Gloria Michelle and a net that's a lot better than the federal net for catching Young of the Year cod. But then their survey pretty much stops at the eastern end of the island because it's very difficult and dangerous to fish on the eastern end. I've been saying for years that the shoals are the major place for Young of the Year and one-year-old cod. There was a lot of industry comment back 10, 15 years ago about cod being present in the fingers that are on the southern part of Nantucket running up into the shoals. Whenever we did an albatross survey, you could see a little bit of it. We couldn't get far in there, but we caught cod. And then we start seeing the federal survey, both the trawl survey and the dredge survey, can't really fish a lot of that bottom because it's hard. And the consequence is where it's capable of fishing starts sliding up with cod again. And so we have a dense concentration of cod on the western side of the shoals. And then where the survey picks up again, we see the cod again. So I'm pretty sure that the shoals are a very important place for cod. We're just not sampling there. They certainly don't fly over the shoals. They're on the shoals. And that's the main point I want to make. I wish that we could get the Massachusetts to take the Gloria Michelle in their net and survey in federal waters, and especially on top of the bank this summer, to demonstrate, in fact, where the Young of the Year caught are. As I mentioned earlier today, we don't have a sampling year for Young of the Year fish. It's just a big hole in our database. Thank you.
Peter.
Thank you. Peter Taylor, fisherman from Chatham. I've been either gill netting or long lining for since 1972. This is my backyard. I know this bottom, the codfish bottom down there, better than probably anybody alive today. I don't know what your goals are, but especially five, it's all sand. There hasn't been codfish there for 20 years. I could have brought, somebody told me I should bring my books with all my hard bottom spots and stuff. And guess what? They don't belong in there. None of these things really work well, although there's one that has a little bit of stuff to the east, but it needs to slide to the east if you really want to do something. It's what you guys want to do. And I'm old enough now that I almost don't care anymore, but if you're going to protect codfish, let's not kid anybody that you're going to do it in a pile of sand. We used to fill up the kid's sandbox with this crap. You know, this is not where codfish live. So anybody tells you otherwise about the so-called experts about that area, well, I know that whole area down there. I can map it out with my eyes closed, and that's not a good spot. Thank you.
Gib.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gib Brogan with Oceana. We oppose this motion. Alternative 5 doesn't do the job for this area, and we encourage the council to look at least Alternative 3 and look back at the process that this council went through in developing Alternative 3 and adding more area to the east. We think at a minimum that's what's necessary to be effective in this area, and that even beyond going further to the east beyond that may be necessary to make this an effective area for protecting cod and other important species that are in this area. The alternative in the motion right now is largely ineffective. A lot of the work that was done during the development of this alternative and the crafting of Alternative 3 showed that this is unlikely to do the job, that Alternative 5 is unlikely to do the job. So we encourage you to reject this one and at a minimum look at Alternative 3 as the necessary action for this area, but even more that you may need to develop an alternative that goes beyond Alternative 3. Thanks very much.
Peter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Peter Gigliani, Northeast Seafood Coalition. It would be helpful to maybe, if there's a way to put up some type of SASE or the best of the four charts for folks to see. But full disclosure, the issues that we had with those other alternatives were they got right into the areas in the channel where southern New England winter flounder, which was just recently allocated and is a viable fishery right now, is almost all prosecuted right there on that edge of the closure. So that particular east longitude line is what we were trying to hold. But we want to be consistent with SASE, so let's just, you know, take a look at it and see, you know, why folks think that something east of that is superior. And just one last thing to leave with it, whatever we do close here is, as far as I know, is going to be close to either Option 1 measures or Option 2 measures. It will not be closed to gear capable.
Peter?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of council. My name is Peter Hughes. I'm with Atlantic Cape Fisheries in Cape May, New Jersey. I came to the microphone earlier, so you know that we are involved in three fisheries in the New England region, the scallop fishery, the groundfish fishery, and that we own some groundfish that we lease into the various sectors up in New England, and we're also involved in the clam fishery. And the current option that's on the board, option five, would have to have similar language as the previous motions we made when it came to Georgia's Bank, in that they would look at option number one and option number two as far as gears are concerned. But, you know, in reading a letter that was released last week by the regional administrator, John Bullard, in looking at the Great South Channel, it's been described by people here on the council and some commenters in the audience that it's a giant sandbox. And it even says in this letter that it is very complicated by the minimal benefit to be gained to EFH due to the very high energy in this area. It's sand. If we put a box around it, all we're going to do is protect clams. That is going to it's going to prevent vessels from Cape Cod and vessels out of New Bedford who work the surf clam fishery from participating in that fishery. So I would please hope that you would take this into consideration and possibly look at alternative two. Thank you.
John?
Judd Crawford, Pew Charitable Trust. We don't support this as a preferred alternative. Looking at the table and the analyses that have been done that you have from a biological perspective and the goals and objectives of the amendment, it seems pretty clear that something like alternative three is the best thing that's there now. I also would draw attention to the fact that we have also, similar to Georgia's Bank, we outlined an alternative for this area that also could be considered, that's quite similar to alternative three, but also seeks to protect some of the shoal water just south of Nantucket that has been protected through a habitat area in the past. Thank you.
Tom?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Tom Slaughter. I also work for Atlantic Capes, but I am in the clam division. I also was a clam fisherman for years. I would like to have just described to you a little bit about that bottom out there. The bottom is, we talk about high-energy sand. It changes depth every tide change as much as 40 feet. You see waves of sand, well, you know, going right across the shoals. Now, my guess is that if you picture Phoenix in the dust storms, that's about what it looks like down there. Fish don't swim through the shoals. They go around them. They're just not there. I don't believe there's been 10 fish caught in 20 years on the shoals. And the draggers are not there because there's no fish there. They haven't been there for years. So to say that, you know, certain industries are going to prohibit their fishing effort there, they haven't been fishing there for years, like decades. But the clams are there. And it's a beautiful resource. It's not overfished. The recruitment is unbelievable. I mean, there are more clams showing up day in and day out. And it is a fishery, as other people will probably describe, that is worth a lot of money. It is the largest fishery in New England. 200 million tons of clams come in here, basically all in the port of New Bedford. That's a lot of weight, and that translates to a lot of dollars and a lot of people involved in it. And if you shut Nantucket Shoals down, 20 boats just go out of business. Or maybe some of them could move to the Mid-Atlantic, but they wouldn't choose to move to the Mid-Atlantic. So they're out of business. And every bowl of New England clam chowder that you've eaten in the last 10 years, the clams came from that one spot, unless you ate Campbell's, and then it came from the Georgia's Banks area. So I thank you for your time.
Jim?
Yes, Jim Odlin, Portland, Maine. owner of 5 groundfish boats. 2 of our groundfish boats fish exclusively out of New Bedford. And we fish on channel flounders, winter flounder, when they've been allocated. Now, they just got allocated them last year, and it was one of the only things that we had done to mitigate the cuts that we took in other species. So I think the quota was something like 2.5 million pounds or something. I'd be willing to bet that 70 or 75% of it comes out of that sliver to the east of this proposal. And I know there's a lot of scallops in there. So it's very important for New Bedford. It's very important for the boats that are able to try to fish out of New Bedford. And I just want to point out, you know, as Ron mentioned, I mean, if you take the area that the motion identifies, it has a lot of red in it. And the only reason it doesn't have more red in it is that it's further, it's not surveyed as much further to the west. So, but even if you just look at it this way, well, you know, taking an area that we haven't had any protection in, we're protecting half of the red area, and we're still allowing 2 fairly, I would say, major fisheries to be prosecuted. And I would say that's a practical approach, right? You're gaining a lot of protection, and you're still allowing a couple of fisheries to function. But if you move this to the west, and the reason you're going to the east, I'm sorry, if you move this to the east, the reason it's going to be identified is we want to protect juvenile cod. But if you do that, then I submit you need to make sure it's close to all gear capable of catching groundfish, because we know that the exemption is for a gear that has no selectivity on juvenile codfish to speak of. So I support this motion, and I think it's a practical approach. You're getting a lot of red, and you're still allowing some fisheries to be prosecuted. Thank you.
Sarah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sarah Smith with EDF. We are also would not support this motion and would prefer to see alternative 3 selected as the preferred alternative. Just looking at this map that's up here with the Lisa clusters and juvenile cod makes it pretty clear that in terms of encompassing better habitat and a better solution, that alternative 3 includes more cobble and boulder habitat, according to the DEIS, than do the other alternatives, and also has the highest concentrations of juvenile and sublegal cod in this area. Tom Dempsey made a really good point earlier in talking about Georges Bank and saying that as far as the clam dredge exemption, if we're encompassing the right areas with these closed areas, then we don't really need to worry about clam dredges as much, because we're not closing areas of sand. So from that perspective, it seems to make sense to focus more on areas that we know are better habitat, both from a habitat perspective and from a juvenile fish perspective. Thank you.
Drew.
Drew McGavis, Fisheries Survival Fund. Thank you. One of the great things about this area is that, thanks to the scallop survey that was funded by scallop research set-aside funds, we have a lot of data in this area. If you were to look at the underlying sort of the Voronoi tessellations that show you how much data there is underneath this layer of SASE impacts, you would see very tight polygons, because there is a picture of the bottom that has been analyzed by scientists in a peer-reviewed manner of a whole lot of that bottom, except for towards the west, as you get closer to Nantucket. What the red boxes show you is the dominant substrate of that area as categorized in a uniform manner, and red means rock. Is there also sand in that 10 by 10 kilometer box? Yes, because bottom is not monolithic. Bottom, it transitions a lot from spot to spot, and you get different bottom types within a 10 by 10 kilometer square. And it was, and the decision was made many years ago that it didn't make any practical sense to start managing down to a smaller unit than a 10 by 10 kilometer square. So while you could have a clam dredge and a clam fishery within an area that's also highlighted as rocky bottom, because you could have sand next to rock, that happens all the time. The fishermen know where it is at that micro level. but we're not managing at a micro level. And what you see here are option five and other options are options that contain the majority of the red squares. You also recall way back when, in the now the considered but rejected pile, there were four individual boxes. Mr. McKenzie made a motion, let's have one box. It didn't make sense to have four. And then we all got together and created these that had comparable habitat value to those original four. So that's why we are here. And we would, and the reason you don't hear anyone in the industry talking about alternative three is because that's the one that goes too far and then has extreme consequences for economically for very little gain. To quote a prominent member of the Scala PDT, they aren't really seriously considering that area, are they, when she was referring to alternative three, because it's not practicable in any way, especially for any gain you get from that small bump out to the east. So that's what we're talking about. We have data here. The data says it's rocky bottom. Yes, there's sand in there, but that's because we don't do it down to the micro level. And so your data is good here. It's laid out, and you have boxes that address the issue. Thank you.
Greg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Greg Cunningham with the Conservation Law Foundation. I won't reiterate the good comments of my colleagues at PU, EDF, and Oceana, but I do think that this picture does tell a story. What it doesn't tell you is that the majority of the red squares are contained within the proposal that's on the board. I'll leave that counting to you, but the majority of them are outside of it. And what this does is by shifting off of where the most vulnerable habitat is and where the fish are, it compromises the closure. I'm sounding a little like a broken record here, but it compromises the ability of this closure to function and to serve the purpose for which you are making some sacrifices. If you are going to make sacrifices both for the ecosystem and for the industry, let's do it in a way, in a manner that will succeed. Thank you.
Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Patrick Paquette, and for today, on behalf of the recreational advisors, we, and forgive me because I am not an expert in the area, although I've fished in a bunch, I just want to make sure give that council a heads up that I know that there is. So we used to, ports up and down across New England, from southern New England all the way up to Gloucester, used to run multiple day long trips. I'm talking about on the big head boats, on the 100 footers that have taken 60 to 80 passengers on these 2 and 3 day, what we'll call distance trips. Georges Bank is sort of no longer a viable target. This is the rare guy who goes out and tries to make a trip there. But in general, there is still an existing targeting fishery, I'm pretty sure, out of Rhode Island, from Rhode Island boats and southern New England boats. And I know at least Joe Huck, who was here yesterday, his boat fishes down. I'm not 100% aware where this goes into it, but there is definitely a large boat recreational fishery that is targeting some of this area. And I mean, Frank's at the table, so I'm once again going to just say I know what I don't know, but I just want to give you the heads up that there is an existing fishery that's worth some money that's prosecuted, and it's also the only place that those particular sort of what I'm going to call vessels that are distant specialists can really fish anymore, because Georges Bank is sort of not viable because it's not, the payoff's not there. Thank you.
Dave.
Yes, Dave Wallace, representing the clam industry. The first thing I would like you to do is to have you reference page 25 in your document, and I suggest that ultimately the council choose alternative number two. It has the fewest negatives and the most positives of any of the considerations, and therefore seems to make a great deal of sense that that should be done. You know, if we were to have access to the entire shoals, the vessels would be able to fish on even higher concentrations of clams, which means their footprint would be even smaller, so that we get two benefits. The vessels catch quicker, and there is less damage to the there's less bottom cover to because of the fishing effort. As I said earlier today, the hydraulic dredges on high energy sand have little or no impact in the long term, and therefore it's a good reason to do it. There are very few juvenile groundfish in the area, there's very little complex except to the east, clams do not, surf clams and ocean cogs do not live in complex bottom because there's no place for them to live. Our gear is designed not to, we couldn't use our gear in complex bottom because a clam dredge costs about $60,000. You tow it into a boulder or a wreck, and you have done severe damage to that, and the trip is over, and it'll take you weeks, if not, it could take you weeks to repair the damage. The surf clam and ocean cog have almost no bycatch, and our bycatch of regulated fisheries are less than 1%, and that was information that I received from the National Marine Fisheries Service on their survey cruises of the Delaware II. Dr. Weinberg actually provided me that information a number of years ago. There's about $80 million worth of ex-plant revenue from the clam industry on Georges Banks and Nantucket Shoals. That is compared to the scallop industry. The scallop industry shucks their clams, their scallops at sea. We can't do that because we catch such huge volumes. So we have shucking plants that process them. Just the output of the shucking plants in New England is about $80 million a year. Once they are secondarily processed, it goes to like $250 million. We have the area swept by hydraulic dredges is 227 coming out of the report versus lobster pots at 340, limited access scallops at 3,000, and outer trawls at 49,000 square meters. And so, the clam industry needs to be able to operate. We provide 700 jobs in New England. Thank you very much.
Eric.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Eric Hansen. Heard some testimony here today where one fisherman came up and says, I know this bottom, like the back of my hand, and there's no fish there, which begs the question, why does he know it like the back of his hand if there's no fish there? Another one comes up and says that there's a viable headboat fishery there. So that says there are fish there. And then you've got another, Ron came up earlier and said that there's a lack of data. So we really don't have a lot of hard data as far as where the fish are, from my perspective, but we do have a SASE map that lights up red. So I'd like to, speak in favor of the motion with the best available science that we have, which encompasses a good chunk of the red squares in the SASE map. Thank you.
In the back, in the blue shirt.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman. Al Rankerell, Westport, Mass. I own three vessels in out of Hyannis and New Bedford, and we fish on Nantucket Shoals for surf clams. We've been out there since, I've been fishing out there since 1992. So I think it would be a big economical impact if we close this Nantucket Shoals down. We go from the top to the bottom of the shoals. And I'm very concerned about that, and I support Tom Slaughter and Dave Wallace on what they have to say. That's it.
Is there anybody else in the audience who'd like to comment? Seeing none, we're coming back to the council. Tom?
Thanks. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that, and I appreciate the range of input that we've gotten from the public on this. Looking at this section of the document, you know, I've had dozens of conversations with fishermen that fish the channel their entire careers, look at alternatives 5 and 6, and scratch their heads and wonder what in the world someone would put a box for habitat protection in those areas. I mean, it's hard to defend. It really is. I mean, people just laugh and say, no, that can't possibly be what you're trying to do. You completely missed the point. I mean, the hard bottom is to the east. And I can't support this alternative. I said it before with regards to the western box that was put in and the AFM coalition alternative earlier. If clams are such a big issue and it's going to have such a huge impact on the clam fishery, your box is probably in the wrong spot, and we've heard that time and time again here. This is a huge issue for the clam fishery. That should be a huge red flag for everyone at this table saying the box is in the wrong spot. It needs to move east. At the very least, it can't be selected as our preferred alternative for how we're going to protect the important habitat that's here in the channel. And Georgia's Bank codfish that people are talking about protecting are at best 7% of our biomass target. This is habitat protection, and the channel has hard bottom, and it's on the east side of our range of alternatives here. If anything, they should move even further east. That's the feedback I've gotten from dozens of guys who've spent their entire careers here. So with that said, I can't support choosing alternative 5. I think it has unnecessary negative impacts on the clam fishery. It's a box of convenience, I think. And I think at the very best we should send this out without preferred alternatives. We have 4 spatial areas here. That's even fewer than we have on the Georges Bank area that we just voted out without preferred alternatives. Let's let people comment on the full range. So with that said, I'd move to substitute that the council choose no preferred habitat alternative for the Great Salt Channel in southern New England.
Seconded by Matt McKenzie. David Pierce.
I don't favor the motion. I think we are in a position to pick a preferred, and I say that because I've spent a lot of time focusing on this particular set of alternatives for this very important area. I do agree with Tom that the motion on the board, that is the motion, the original motion, is difficult to sell as a preferred. Too much area is mud and silt and sand, and I've said from the beginning with my involvement in the habitat discussions that I'm going to be influenced very heavily by bottom type, by where there is cobble and where there is boulder, where there is rock that actually can potentially support 3D structure there and provide some protection, some habitat protection for juvenile fish. And when I look at map 40 in the document on page 186, I see that the area to the east is the area that we should be looking at. It jumps right out at us, red, orange. You know, of course, there's also some mud and silt, and there's some sand in there. Nothing is straight rock. Nothing is straight boulder and gravel. So I'm inclined to support alternative 4 as the preferred. We have this motion on the board, which is no preferred, so I will oppose that. I think alternative 4 is one that we should offer up as a compromise between important habitat protection as an option that does, through the SASE analysis, capture those areas where we seem to have vulnerable habitat that is in need of some protection. So that You know, that those are features of alternative four that's very attractive to me. I wouldn't pick the triangle that's associated with alternative three, only because it goes a bit too far. And I want to strike a balance between not taking away too much access for vessels, be they scallops or be they draggers, and providing a significant amount of protection for bottom habitat. In addition, someone said it, maybe it was Terry, that I'm also concerned that if indeed we did close, well, for any of these options, if we did close them down to mobile gear fishing, then we create a preserve for hook fishing and gill netting. And I think eventually we might get to the point where we're ready to make a motion that would be similar to the one I think Terry made yesterday with the Eastern Maine, where we can get some support. We can get a large amount of support for the option that we pick to protect habitat if we don't create a preserve for other gear types, which is foolish. Yes, we need to protect habitat, but not create a sanctuary of sorts for one gear type or another. So I'm going to oppose the motion for no preferred. I'm going to oppose the motion, the original motion, and work my way towards alternative four as a preferred.
On the motion, substitute, Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I second this motion because I feel that the alternative five is just not, it doesn't hit the right markers. I mean, if we move east, we're getting better substrate. We're getting more of what we've identified in our analysis, Young of the Year cod. We also have from the SAWSARC 54 report location of herring spawning off those areas. And based upon the Stellwagen Bank final management plan from 2010, there's a large distribution of another important key food source in the area, that's sand lance, that from Mike Palmer's work a couple years ago shows does a really, really, and plays a really, really important role in, when it comes to cod spawning congregations up in Stellwagen Bank and elsewhere. Ultimately, though, I think picking a preferred alternative here is asking us to make compromises when we're really not prepared to make compromises. We need to get this out to public comment. The public should not be encouraged to zero in on one alternative rather than the full range that are here. So I support this motion, and I oppose the underlying motion.
Terry.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I support not picking a preferred here. You know, it seems like we have a narrow range here that we could. But I really keep referring back to John Bullard's letter that pretty much says that a lot of people's interpretation of that letter is, we don't need anything in the South Channel. So at the risk of putting you on the spot, John, I wish you could clarify that for us. That might steer our direction here.
John.
Thank you for the apple, by the way, this morning. I know I owe you a vote at some point and at some future council meeting. This is it. Before the apple rots, I owe you a vote. So the intent of the language in the letter, I'm sure it's been overinterpreted, was really that we think that because of high energy in the bottom here, that it is this will probably be misinterpreted too, that it's less that habitat protection here is less valuable than it is to the east. It's not to say it's not valuable, but less valuable, and it shouldn't be used to compensate for subtractions in eastern Georgia's by making larger places here. Does that make sense? So that's not to say we shouldn't have protection here. That's not what we meant. But it's not a place to make up ground if we may area is too small in one place, we could make up for it here. So we think protection is deserved here. We would have favored four, I suppose. I can't believe I'm agreeing once again with Dr. Pierce. This is getting to be a bad habit of mine, I think. But
if,
I know. I know. So we do think that a habitat protection area in this area is warranted, because of the characteristics of the bottom and the currents, it's a different place than Eastern Georgia's. Did I answer your question, Terry? Do I owe you the apple back?
Can I follow that up then, Terry? Okay, so we've never had anything in this area before. So everything here is a bonus. That's the way I read it. I don't know if everybody else reads it that way, but everything here is a plus. And this plus that the industry's put forward will add some habitat protection, protect some young of the accord. I mean, maybe not the masses out to the east or whatever you want to call them, but it'll protect the young of the accord. We protect those cod with mesh size anyway, and I'm going to say that right till this gets voted out in the end. I'm going to keep saying that because that's how we do it. We brought back redfish doing that. That's how we protect cod, young of the accord. And this alternative adds protection, and if this motion fails, I'm going to support the main motion to support the industry motion. So hopefully this motion will fail.
Doug.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And first of all, John, if you check your briefcase, you may find a warm chocolate chip cookie in there, courtesy of... I oppose this motion because I think we have enough information and options here to provide a preferred alternative here. Again, it all depends on what your definition of to the extent practicable. I agree with Dr. Pierce that I think a better preferred alternative from our standpoint for this amendment would be for alternative four, option two, because it does provide benefits to the habitat over the preferred alternative. It is not as good as number three, but it does not have the economic impact that alternative three does. Clearly, my concern with alternative five is I think alternative four does get at a little bit closer to the more complex bottom habitat type based on what I've seen through the SASTI analysis. So I will oppose this and would support any motion for a preferred alternative for number four.
Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for a point of clarification, this, Terry, with all due respect, this is not a bonus. If any of the alternatives put forward today, other than alternative one, go through, we lose both Nantucket Lightship and closed area one. Those areas have been closed more or less for quite some time. And I just wanted to correct that this is not purely additive. This is a replacement of current and existing closed areas.
Mary Beth.
I guess the first thing I'd like to point out is that apples are better for you than chocolate chip cookies, warm or not. So just take that into consideration. I'm wondering, Michelle, if you could put up that previous map that had the SASTI overlay, because that seemed to be an easier way to compare the alternatives.
This one from page 186.
It looked different when it was up there. No, that's the one. I think that I'm not sure where I stand on the motion to amend. think the motion to amend is preferable to some of the motions being considered that might replace it. I think there's, as been mentioned, there's a lot of high-resolution data for the area. I think that the industry proposal, I do support the underlying motion that was originally on the board, is a really good attempt at trying to capture some dense habitat. I think it's been pointed out that protections in this area don't have as much value as they do in other areas. And this the industry proposal is an attempt to protect some really tight clusters of hard bottom and allow fishing to occur. I think, again, similar to the discussions we had on Georges Bank about impacts to the clam industry, I think that those need to be worked out, and I don't think that they're insurmountable. I think that can occur. I certainly have no interest in having a significant impact on clamming to the extent that was described to us. Alternative 4 that people are talking about, even though it's not a motion on the board, the impacts of that, to me, are unacceptable to a broad range of fisheries, not just to the scallop fishery, but also the groundfish fishery, and we've heard people speak to that. So I don't think we're trying to, we're not trying to protect every red square out there. We're trying to get at, some concentrations that will give us some bang for the buck, and the industry proposal does that, and I would not support alternative 4. I think this motion is preferable to that.
Tom.
Thanks. I won't take too long, but in this conversation, since this motion to substitute went up, we've heard support for picking no preferred. We've heard support for alternatives 2, 4, and 5, and maybe others. We've had this thing for almost a decade. It's time to send it out to public comment. Let's let everybody talk about the alternatives that have support right now or have expressed support right at this council for, almost every option. So let's just send it out without preferreds. It seems like, as we've talked, it's just making the case that we're not in a position to pick a preferred. We've had it for a long time. Let's let the industry, let's let stakeholders go through the public process and have their opportunity to look at this full range of all options and provide a broad range of input. It seems very clear that we're divided. It's time to send it out the door. No preferred. Vote this up, and we can move on.
Frank.
Yes, thank you. And, Tom says we've been on this for 10 years. I'm not quite sure that's correct. I think if you look around the room, Dave Pierce might remember, and Dave Borden might remember, but this is the most contentious area there was. Back for Amendment 7. Back when these areas first got closed, if you take out, I usually have it with me. I don't have it. I usually have the public hearing document back from those. I kind of like some of the things that were in there. It basically said this was the area, and everybody did everything they possibly could for the last 25 years not to put any protection in this area. Not that we don't have anything in that area. And that was the area that has been lit up from way back when. The area has changed greatly in the last 25 years, with the different gears that have come in and out of there, with the different storms and stuff. It is a dynamic area. But the reason nobody's done anything is because it is the most contentious area. I might agree. Well, I think I do agree with Tom here that we should go out and get comments on them all. I have my preference here on which one I think I would prefer. But like I said, there's a reason why nothing's been picked for here.
Sorry.
Yeah, Tom Strong had me into voting this way, so I think I am going to support the no preferred because of all the arguments around the table, even Matt McKenzie's.
You orchestrated that. Laura.
I just want to make sure that our guest is noticing how well we get along around the table.
Further comments on the motion to substitute? Seeing none, those support the motion to substitute, please indicate so. And those opposed? The motion carries 13-3. We're back to the main motion as substituted. Same sign. Those who support the main motion as substituted. And those opposed? Same count. Motion passes 13-3. Is there any more business with the sub-management sub-areas? David?
Yeah, regarding this particular sub-area and all the options, we have no preferred. When we bring it to public hearing, I assume we're going to be saying to those who are in attendance that in all these areas, mobile gear will be excluded. Potentially, there'll be an exemption for hydraulic clam dredges, but anybody with a hook and anybody with a gill net can go inside. Okay, that's the understanding. So I find that to be kind of the death knell for any of these options, since it becomes a real serious allocation issue. Yes, it's about habitat, but the end result will be reallocating an area so that it will be used by one or two different gear types to the exclusion of others, giving them a tremendous competitive advantage over others in the area. So I would move that for the Great South Channel, Southern New England alternatives, habitat management alternatives, that option two be modified so that it would read no mobile bottom tending gears with an exemption for hydraulic clam dredges, and then additionally no gill nets or hooks. And this again makes us consistent with the approach we use for eastern Gulf of Maine area.
David, want to check your motion? Make sure it's what you want.
Yes, hydraulic clam dredges. That's
it. Are you seconding it, PK? Terry, you're seconding it. Second by Terry Alexander. Tom Neese. Go ahead.
Yeah, regarding the logic behind it, I'm going to reference the point made by Andy yesterday when we talked about, I think it was yesterday, it was. Anyways, when we referenced the Eastern Georges Bank area and Terry made the point about, no hooks, no gill nets, all gear, Andy noted one possible reason for it that relates to the objectives, the goals and objectives of the omnibus, and I would suggest that we could use as logic for this in the table, in the listing of objectives, improve ground fish spawning protection, including protection of localized spawning contingents or subpopulations of stocks, and improve refuge for critical life's history stages. That would be another bit of rationale for that. And I think Andy also had another one that I can't recall offhand. But anyways, that to me, those are some good reasons for including those two gear types, because, again, if we don't have these gear types excluded, I think we're going to end up, it'll be very difficult for us to adopt, for some of us anyways, to adopt any measures that will protect large amounts of habitat when other gear types are free to go in.
Before we carry on, Michelle, Annie, is this essentially option two already?
Right now, option two is no mobile bottom tending gears exempting hydraulic clam dredges. None of the habitat management areas would restrict non-mobile bottom tending gears, so would restrict gill nets. That goes beyond anything we've talked about.
Okay, before this gets debated by the council, we're gonna go out to the audience. Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smolowitz. I support this motion. Two points regarding clam dredges. I've done a lot of work with clam dredges. I've rode on top of them, dove in their dive paths, videoed them, and they're not geared to worry about vis-a-vis habitat. And I could explain that in a lot more detail. Regarding gill nets and hooks, this is something that's occurred all over the world where you end up putting in a gear regulation and force the industry to switch to another gear type and find out that you went from the frying pan into the fire. You do not want to increase gill nets and hook fishing in the channel from a perspective of protected species. And I think you just have to be aware that there's a real big consequence. And like I said yesterday, if the goal is to protect the spawning population of codfish, and there are a lot of codfish in the channel, and the idea is to take fishing pressure off of them, then go do it. I don't necessarily think that's a good idea, but you might as well go one way or the other. And if you're protecting large codfish, you can't allow a fishery to direct on them.
Okay. Before we go to Patrick, a question for Dr. Pierce. Is your intent this is for both commercial and recreational, or just commercial fisheries?
I knew you'd ask that question. Commercial.
Put that in the motion. Karen, could you add that in? We're still in the public. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Absolutely not on behalf of the Recreational Advisory Panel of the following comments I'm going to make. And it's not specific to this, but thank you, David, because you sort of took some. But I want to take the opportunity very quickly to say this. Personally, as a member of public and as one of the, I guess you'd say most active recreational advocates on the East Coast, there are clearly places that we don't belong. And there are clearly places that we have to be because of their location. But I'm going to go back to some of the comments that Ron Smolowitz, although I don't agree, I don't end up at the same place as he does, but if this is about habitat, you know what I mean? We're going to be singing the song through the rest of the development of this amendment about 16-ounce sinkers and 20-ounce jigs, and please show me how the damage that that's doing. And if it's about habitat, it's not a gear restriction. It's about how the gear affects the bottom and the habitat, which is different than I thought one of the big reasons behind this, or the big public stated reasons behind this amendment is about, these were mortality closures. Well, the minute we start talking about no matter what size fish we're trying to protect, we're back to mortality closures and we're not talking about habitat protection. And so it's something that just keeps occurring to me in these places that I believe that my community belongs and doesn't belong in the document, and I'm not going to waste your time much longer. I just wanted to, as this came up, it was sort of like, are we talking about protecting the hard bottom in the channel, or are we talking about who can fish there? And those are two very different questions. And semantics, and there's lawyers and professional advocates and some of the best in the world around this table, which is why this council has its reputation. And I'm part of making that reputation. But I just say that it's sort of, I think we need to make sure that we're focused, because the public hearings is going to be really easy to spin this thing off the hook. And if it's about habitat protection, you're just going to have to sort of explain to the recreational community how 16-ounce sinkers are doing damage, but clam dredges aren't. Thank you.
Further comments from the audience? Vito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're a little torn on this. No question we sympathize with the clam dredge situation. We think it needs to be dealt with, but the option two is an option already. The option two measures is there. And I mean, preferably, I just see these as two separate things, splitting this into, option two is exemption for dredges. And, we have a concern with blanket exemption for dredges in the same area that you don't allow other gear types that are the same or less disruptive. And I think that's what Patrick was trying to say is, how do you compare a sinker to a hydraulic dredge? So that's the part we're having a hard time, swallowing. But we don't want to see the clam industry in a situation where the only way they can prosecute a fishery is to not pass the red face test with a, well, give it a blanket exemption. But we cannot let the fishery get crushed either. So that's a separate thing. As far as protecting an area, because when I see that, it's, I still don't see it as being objective when we move things east and west and red's red. We're taking a southern New England winter flounder hit big time on that move to the east. And so if we're doing it more for cod protection or fish protection, as Ron said, then, you know, we do understand possibly that if we're going to try to have areas for refuge for fish that we exclude all gear capable of catching. We support that concept. But linking the two with a, anytime you exempt, in order to have hooks and gill nets not in an area, you've got to exempt hydraulic dredges. I just see them as two apples and oranges in one motion. So I'm torn with this. If you could split it, that would make a lot more sense.
Further comments from the audience? Seeing none, we're back to the council. Tom?
Thanks. Well, I guess I'll start by asking Michelle a question, and then I'll probably provide my perspectives on the motion. Michelle, what were the there was an effort early on to create a currency of bottom impacts by gear type. Could you pull up those indicators or give us an overview of the relative scale of impacts on seafloor habitat for, I think the range went from hydraulic clam dredge to jig. And not, I don't think that was separated by recreational commercial jigs since it's the same gear.
There's a lot of information in Volume 1 on this issue. Comparing, when we developed the Swiftery Seabed Impact Analysis, we looked at trawls, bottom trawls, dredges, scallop dredges, hydraulic clam dredges, sink gill nets, demersal long lines, and traps. And this figure that Andy is showing sort of puts all of those vulnerability scores on the same scale. And what we did with sort of the base case of the model was to put the same amount of kilometer squared of area swept into the model for every gear type. And what varies, and then the underlying substrate data is obviously the same for all gear types. And what really varies are the susceptibility scores, so the initial sort of damage caused by the gear and then the length of the recovery times. And so when you put that through the model, what you end up with is for the same amount of inputs of area swept, you end up with much higher vulnerability of habitats to hydraulic dredges, sort of in the middle are trawls and scallop dredges, and at the low end are fixed gears. So sort of broadly speaking, the conclusion that we came to out of this was that the fixed gears, you know, have a sort of much lower impact. And in terms of the actual susceptibility and vulnerability estimates that we were coming up with, the susceptibility estimates for fixed gears were generally on the order of like 10 to 15%. And the recovery times were on the order of less than a year to 1 to 2 years. And so generally, if we're talking about that in terms of sort of thinking about the adverse effects language in the EFH regulations, that means that the fixed gears are having sort of a minimal and temporary impact is the conclusion we reached, which is why in sort of moving forward with developing management measures for this amendment, we focused on the mobile bonnet tending gears and not the fixed ones. There is a lot more uncertainty in terms of estimates of vulnerability to fixed gears because there's simply far fewer studies that have looked at it, because I guess others have sort of presumed that the impact isn't really there, so it hasn't really been as much of a research question. You know, so admittedly, we know a lot less. And then there's a bunch of sort of figures on the pages that follow from there that show sort of the distribution of vulnerability scores. We think that the same locations are probably vulnerable to these other different gear types. So the sort of distribution of the colors on the gill net and long line maps are really similar to the areas that sort of light up on the trawl and scallop dredge maps. But the magnitude of the scores is much lower. And then if you look at, if you sort of go forward to the next sections, you can get a sense of the realized adverse effects estimates. So if you put in real fishing effort data, how do the magnitudes compare? And this is what Doug was getting at earlier. And again, just because the fixed gears sweep so much less area than a mobile gear that is just much wider footprint, the sort of absolute realized estimates are also a lot less for fixed gears.
Just to follow up on that, would that be orders of magnitude less from one end of the scale to the other?
In terms of the realized adverse effects, yes.
Well, I think that's all we really need to talk about. I mean, this habitat amendment is about just that, habitat. As Tom Neese pointed out earlier, this isn't about restricting takes of this or that. We have depleted stocks, and they need help. These quotas are probably still too high in a lot of cases, and we need to reduce mortality. But this habitat action was only developed to support habitat protections, improving those habitat protections to increase outcomes for those stocks and, you know, to meet our obligations to protect sensitive seafloor habitat. I mean, the idea that we would have a habitat area, a defined habitat area, that we would kick out recreational and commercial jig fleet and let in hydraulic clam dredge, I don't know how anyone logically gets there and calls it a habitat protection. It's something else. I mean, we could argue about whether we want to redesignate this a mortality closure, but the fact that we're talking about letting in gears that have orders of magnitude more impacts on the bottom than the gears that we're excluding, I mean, it's hard to fathom. I oppose this. I've opposed adding any new alternatives, but I just don't see how this passes a straight face test. This isn't about habitat, and this isn't the action to create MPAs. If we want to reduce mortality, we should have that conversation in groundfish. I supported reducing the groundfish and cod quotas on Georgia's Bank and the Gulf of Maine. Not everybody did, but I thought those quotas were too high and we needed to protect groundfish. This is not the way to do this. This just doesn't make any sense. I don't see how we can provide a rationale in this document that creates a habitat area that allows the hydraulic clam dredges and not jigs. It's hard to fathom.
Frank?
Yes, thank you. I agree with Tom there, too. And I'm also looking at the areas to the west and the Cox's Ledge area. You're not kicking out any gear to let anybody else in. You couldn't tow in those areas if you had to. I mean, you couldn't put mobile gear in there under, I mean, I've fished that area, I've fished the channel, but Cox's Ledge for, you know, I don't want to say how many years. But there's no possible way to tow in those areas. So it's not like you're kicking out one gear and allowing another one in. I mean, there may be a development someday that a gear could get in there, but people have tried roller gears. You can't get a dredge in. I've seen people try clam dredges in there. They go about 10 feet, and then you kind of laugh because they're kind of hung up for quite a while. But so I don't, in that area especially, I don't think that this would be needed, but I would not support this one. Thank you.
John.
I don't want to repeat the last two speakers, but I'm just wondering whether this should be a modification of option two or whether it should be its own option. So that would be simpler, but.
Doug.
Yeah, my comments and questions of the maker were similar, but the first thing I want to address is right now where your exemption is for clam dredges in general, and I believe you said the exemption was only for hydraulic clam dredges, consistent with the other alternatives. So I think the motion needs, after exemption four, we need to put in the word hydraulic. And that was my question was, it looks like you're having that as option number, a modification to option number two as opposed to another option. And is that your intent? That we would not have any option in there that would just have an exemption of no mobile bottom tending gear and exemption for hydraulic clam dredge like we have in all the other options?
David?
Well, if I could get the vote for this particular motion, I wouldn't mind having a separate option for discussion, that being that the area would have an exclusion of hooks commercial hooks and gillnets. So we would leave the options as we discussed it so far. I'll leave it alone and then put that in as a separate option. I don't mind doing that. So I turn to you, Mr. Chairman, for the best course of action as to how to move it forward.
Staff would prefer that.
Okay. Then I would suggest, if there's no objection, the motion be modified so that there be a third option that would have that specific prohibition on gillnets and commercial hooks.
Terry?
Yeah? I was going to ask if we want to split it, but if this works, then that's fine with me.
Matt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with what Tom says. I mean, the analysis that we're looking at is in front of us pretty much says it all. We're looking at orders of magnitude difference between an impact and vulnerability, and I'm opposed to what we're working on right now. I won't be supporting it.
Dave Preble?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't mean to bollocks this up, but the wording on this has gotten pretty convoluted and difficult to follow. It might be a good idea to maybe take a short break to straighten out the wording, unless somebody wants to do it now. It's just this. It's not at all clear.
So that would be a fifth option.
This is just a suggestion to the maker of the motion. We might want to have it read something like this, Karen, that for the Great South Channel, Great South Channel, Southern New England habitat management alternatives, to add a fifth option for management measures that would prohibit sink gillnets and hook fishing. And I think you originally said commercial fishing, but is it now all hooks? So commercial hook fishing. Sink. Yeah, that works. Well, I think if you add this as a fifth option, then presumably you might be able to select more than one option for your management measures if you word it this way. So, you might select 1 and 5 or 2 and 5, or I don't know if the other options could be combined with it or not.
That read better to you, Dave?
It depends on, the only thing I see wrong with it right now is if commercial hook fishing includes charter and head boats, which are commercial boats that hook fish, they do now, and they're starting to do that, yeah.
Well, I mean, what we're going on here, there's actually language in the groundfish regs that defines commercial fishing as fishing that is intended to or results in the barter, trade, transfer, or sale of fish. So party charter boats are not normally considered commercial fishing if they're fishing legally.
PK.
Tuna fish? Where's that falling?
It's commercial groundfish fishing. That's what that's what we've written in other measures. We can write that in here.
Okay, well.
Okay, so change it to commercial groundfish, gillnets, and hook fishing.
Just even with that clarification, I'm still not going to vote for it. Thank you, though.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that the maker of the motion appreciates a suggestion from the executive director. He always has constructive suggestions, and this indeed is constructive, and I would agree that there's a better way to word it, and it's consistent with my intent.
So you're going to bring him an apple, I hope?
Two apples.
Okay. Tom?
Apples flying all over. So let me understand. So this is a habitat action. So we're creating a distinction somehow between the habitat impacts of recreational fishermen and commercial fishermen using the exact same gear. Now we're creating a separate distinction between people using hooks to target, say, tuna fish or swordfish or anything, and people using hooks to target other stocks from a habitat standpoint?
David.
No, it's this is not just a habitat amendment. It's about spawning protection as well, and that's very clear from the goals and the objectives. We need to protect ground fish within areas in order to have juveniles that will take advantage of the habitat. I mean, there's a very strong linkage between protecting spawning fish and protecting the habitat for what comes out of those spawning fish, that is, young. So I completely disagree with Tom's perspective on this. There is a linkage, and it makes no sense to afford an area some protection so that it will provide a reservoir for juvenile ground fish when there will be no juvenile ground fish produced because the spawners have been removed. I mean, the linkage is so wonderful in this amendment. I've always thought it was a wise idea to include them. I know there are some people who think there should be no reference to spawning fish at all, but there has to be. And frankly, by having the reference to spawning fish in here, it enables us to work our way towards a meeting in the future where we will be able to say collectively that one area or another is the best to pick because it affects everybody and not just a few, disadvantaging some and giving tremendous advantage to others. So that's, again, the motion is on the board, and obviously I strongly favor it.
Let's back up to about the 10,000-foot elevation and realize where we are in the process. I mean, this is an alternative that would go in the Great South Channel that has no preferred alternatives. It's adding one more option to an alternative that's in the current document. So, with that context, you have a follow up, Tom, then Jeff Kalin.
Yeah, I guess I would just ask if it's then about spawners. It's just the inconsistency. If it's then about spawners, then how are recreational fishermen fishing the exact same gear not excluded? I mean, if it's either about habitat or not, it's either about spawning fish or not, and we're splitting this thing three different ways. That's the last point I'll make, but it's not about spawning fish either because it's the exact same gear. So, I mean, I don't know how someone – I'll just leave it there. I'll vote this down, hopefully.
Okay. Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I like the idea personally of splitting these two so that the dredge option or the dredge alternative doesn't get hung up on this issue that the council's discussing. But is it at some point before we move on, I'd like to go to this figure that's on the chart or on the screen, which is page 83 of 411. Can I ask a question about that now, Mr. Chairman? Do you want me to hold off till you deal with the motion that's on the board?
Let's deal with the motion on the board.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Frank.
Yeah, thank you. And not that I want to be a history lesson again, but if you go back to why we get the rolling closures and why we get inshore and offshore grounds closed, it's because when the council first picked those areas that were the areas to close, it was like you can't put them all in one spot. You got to make sure you inflict pain on everybody. So we had closures that went up and down the coast and out to the Hague Line and all that. So we made sure we didn't protect the areas that gave you the most bang for the buck. It was make sure that everybody gets affected. And it was we had rolling closures out in areas where there was mud and things like that. And it was just to, I won't say pacify, but to try and get it passed. And if it didn't, they weren't the best solutions that council came up with. Did it pass and satisfy the people that everybody was getting a little bit of pain? It did at the time. But that's why we're still here now, because we didn't do then what would have been the most appropriate thing to do.
Are there any final comments to the motion on the board? Okay, seeing none, those who support the motion on the board, please indicate so. And those who are... Those who are opposed. Yeah. Motion fails 3-12. Is there any further business on with the Great South Channel Southern New England subregion? Let's take a short break and then we're going to go on the spawning areas.
Thank you. So on Georges Bank, Southern New England region, there's three different alternatives for spawning. Alternative one sort of recognizes the spawning benefits of Closed Area 1, Closed Area 2, and then Nantucket Lightship, which are, you know, as year-round closures, which they are currently. And then there's also this between and around these areas. The blue shading on the chart is the seasonal closure in May, which currently is a pretty limited application to common pool vessels. And then alternatives two and three, similar to the ideas in the Gulf of Maine, sort of take some of these areas and keep them, eliminate some areas, and then make the areas that are maintained seasonal rather than year-round. So alternative two on the left would maintain all of Closed Area 1 and Closed Area 2 as spawning closures in the spring months, so starting on February 1st and running through April 30th. And alternative three would just take the northern part of Closed Area 1, which is currently the habitat area, and as well as all of Closed Area 2 for that same season. And then within alternatives two and three, there's options that would either only restrict the operation of commercial gears that catch groundfish, and then there are other options that would additionally restrict recreational gears that catch groundfish. Sort of a nuance that was pointed out to me at the RAP meeting by Frank is that the current measures in these areas, recreational gears are not allowed, and that's sort of the reverse from the Gulf of Maine, where recreational gears are allowed in the areas that were sort of part of these spawning closures. So alternatives 2 and 3B, which would restrict recreational gears, are really sort of a little bit closer to no action measures than 2A. So that's a little bit of a nuance there. In terms of the impacts of these areas, you know, generally speaking, there's really only there's probably some slight impacts on the physical and biological environment of reopening these areas, either year-round for the lightship or seasonally in the cases of Closed Area 1 and 2, because you're allowing fishing on sort of these generally less vulnerable places, presuming you're continuing to protect some other areas and a habitat with habitat management areas. With large mesh groundfish, generally the action alternatives have a negative impact. Keep in mind that in terms of the goals and objectives of the amendment, they are written as improved spawning protection. And so the question is, do a subset of areas and existing areas and seasons improve upon spawning protection? And so sort of by definition, it's difficult to make the argument that they improve spawning protection. So the analysis in the document really focuses on what fraction of spawning activity do we think is still encompassed within these areas if they're only implemented seasonally. Generally, economic and social impacts are fairly positive because you're providing increased access either year-round or seasonally to these different areas. So there's some opportunities for fishing in these different areas. Of course, it's, you know, as I think I mentioned either earlier today or yesterday, it is a little bit difficult to evaluate the exact catch rates and fishing opportunities within these areas because they have been closed. We can, you know, look at survey data. We can also look at catches in adjacent areas on observed trips to get a sense of the species composition and catch rates and things like that. So that's in the economic impacts analysis. But generally, you're expecting positive economic and social benefits. Because you do remove some year-round protections, there are some slight negative protected resources concerns, but again, there's overlapping requirements in terms of restricted areas that are deliberately designed around protected resources and also other sort of gear type requirements. And so those are just slight negative impacts.
Question for Michelle. Okay, seeing none, Karen? Okay, comments from the audience to the motion on the board? Maggie.
Thank you. Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine. As I said yesterday, Associated Fisheries of Maine, you know, strongly supports appropriate spawning closures. The industry proposal that we crafted with the Seafood Coalition, the Fishery Survival Fund, supports alternative two with a slight modification on the time frame, but part of the reason why we support that is because those were the historic spawning closures in closed areas 1 and 2, and we feel that they are appropriate times and places, but however, we do modify the date of those closures slightly. Our proposal was silent on whether or not our proposal was silent on the fishing gear restriction. We, again, assumed that these areas would be closed during these spawning times to bottom trawls and scallop dredges, and were silent on other fishing gears. I just wanted to also say that when you look at these spawning closures in sort of in totality with the habitat management alternatives that we supported for both the Great Salt Channel and for George's Bank. You know, I think that's something that's sort of missing, and when we look at the total amount of area that's closed to that would be closed under our preferred alternatives, because we support closing these areas during these times, as well as closing the habitat management areas. So it's important to keep that in mind. And also, in terms of the totality of, you know, amount of fishing that goes on in these areas, should have mentioned earlier when we were discussing George's Bank that our access, or at least the groundfish trawl access to closed area 2, is further limited greatly by our agreement with the offshore lobster and not to be in those areas. So we had calculated that our total time in closed area 2 for the groundfish fleet per year between the habitat management areas, the spawning closures, and the gear agreement was about 135 days. So, again, we totally support alternative 2 with a slight modification in the time frame, and we ask your support for that as a preferred alternative. Thank you.
Ron.
Ron Smallwood, Fishery Survival Fund. Just like to point out that back when these closures were spawning closures, scallop dredging was exempt, and there were reasons for that. And in the Canadian fishery where there's spawning closures, scallop dredging is exempt. And that we just recently changed our access program from the being closed out of the access areas February, March, April to mid-June to a September-October closure, because it greatly reduces our bycatch, and that has to be a careful consideration. I would suggest that the council consider, again, exempting scallop dredging from the seasonal spawning closures, and that we concentrate our closures more towards the reduction of bycatch issues. And, you know, one of the things why we're still negotiating with the lobstermen is we're concerned that we can't have a similar type of agreement with the same seasons the groundfish guys have, because it would force us into a higher bycatch period for access into that area. So in the big picture, I think the council should consider an exemption for scallop dredging and let us concentrate on the most appropriate seasons to maximize the greater amount of benefits.
Other comments from the audience? Vito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just Vito Gigoloni, Northeast Seafood Coalition. I just quickly wanted to explain the proposal for the season change to April 15th. The primary reason for that is that's an extra 2 weeks that the U.S. fishery would have in that area prior to getting shut down. The Canadians basically open up, I believe it's June 1st, and so what would happen is the U.S. would only have 30 days under the April 30th is what it's been, 30 days before you have that heavy Canadian competition coming in January 1st. As Maggie pointed out, the lobster agreement keeps us out of that area most of the year anyway, even though it ends up hopefully opening up. We're keeping ourselves out of there for all but 4 months. So that 2 weeks is really important on that side. The other thing is we recognize the value of spawning, and we hope we know that spawning is a priority, but you really can't do much until you finally get this amendment out the door and you know what areas are going forward, and then we'll deal with spawning after that. So I wanted to explain those 2 weeks are really, really critical on the market end as well. Also, I think it was status quo measures for spawning. We weren't excluding or making any additional restrictions on scallop gear. Whatever's in the current regs for groundfish spawning, that's the same gears that would be not allowed during the seasonal change to closed area 1 and 2.
Judd.
Judd Crawford, Pew Charitable Trust. Like protecting food for fish to eat and places for juvenile fish to grow, protecting spawning is really at the heart of what's intended under EFH in the Magnuson Act, and is common sense and is something that I think there's more agreement on amongst people than anything else probably about what needs to be protected. I don't suggest supporting this particular alternative. I think the information you have before you, again, suggests that the status quo does a better job of achieving this goal. So I would urge you to think about the status quo as the best alternative at this point. Thank you.
Other comments? Jim.
Sorry, Jim Odlin, commercial fisherman from Portland, Maine, with five groundfish vessels. We support this motion. We think spawning is important, and we think this 2 weeks is very important, and mostly not somewhat because of the market situation that we're in with Canada and the complication of the scallop, the lobster agreement, which doesn't give us much time. We found over the recent times that spawning's long been done by April. I mean, we're into post-spawn fish at that time, and every processor knows that. Every fisherman knows that. So, you know, I don't know if it's a new thing or whatever, but the spawning is long over around the first part of April on cod, haddock, and yellowtails in this area. So you're not giving up much but allowing the U.S. fishermen to have it, and we do support spawning closures. And the second thing I think to point out, Maggie touched on it briefly, but if you put the new proposed industry closure up on that that map there, and some, whatever's going to be closed in the channel, you can see that for a full almost 90 days, the industry almost has no place to go. So, I mean, there's a lot going to be closed. So, again, support this motion, and I think, yes, the scallopers should be exempt from these spawn enclosures as they have in the past. Thank you.
Anybody else? Seeing none, back to the council. Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that one thing is that I think it's preferable to do spawning measures in each FMP instead of in the omnibus, and I know that we've made a recommendation to the Groundfish Committee to look at spawning measures. Certainly in the herring plan, in the state's plan, not in the federal plan, that is the way we do it, and I think it's a more comprehensive way to look at individual species. However, I do support the motion on the board. I think there was some confusion when it was developed as to the impact to scallop dredges, but The alternative, as it reads in the document, is pretty clear. So I would make a motion to amend that scarlet dredges be added to the list of exemptions in the document. And it can be found on, I don't know what page this is, page 103, to be consistent with the exemptions that were previously identified for mortality closures. And if I get a second to that motion, I can provide some justification.
Seconded by Laura.
So thank you for that, Mr. Chairman. And when I look through the document, I mean, there's two justifications for excluding scallop dredges, and one is that it could disrupt spawning activity. Well, I mean, I don't think scallop dredges do not disrupt spawning activity to any degree that's greater than those gears already listed in the exemptions. And then the other is that they catch various species of groundfish. Well, I think we all know that the interactions in the groundfish of groundfish in the scallop fishery are flatfish. And in the scallop plan, there's a lot of measures. We have sub-ACLs for most of these species now. The goal of the scallop industry is to minimize those as much as possible. We have, you know, bycatch avoidance programs with SMAS. We have new seasonal closures in these areas to, again, minimize interactions. We have a lot of on-the-water research going on that will continue, that we can continue to refine. So I think for the scallop industry, the most important thing is to not catch them. And as has already been pointed out, we have closures now in access areas that start on August 15th and continue until November 1. And I think that layering additional closures, and we also need to come up with an agreement with the lobster industry that's yet to be defined that would be excluding other months. I think there's plenty of justification here to continue with what has been historically the practice of allowing scallop dredges in these areas.
Tom.
So if I might ask, just for make sure it's clear here, I think the current language says that scallop dredge vessels are exempt from mortality closures if they're fishing in an access area. So they're not allowed to fish in mortality closures. So is the intent here that scallop vessels would be allowed to fish in a spawning area only if there was a scallop access area overlaid?
Well, I also read that language, and so I specifically excluded the reference to access areas because it's a little unclear to me when these areas change that there's a need to have it be that defined in that way. Because these aren't going to be mortality closures any longer. They'll be seasonal spawning closures. So the only restriction would be during those months, and the only time you need the exemption is for that time. So I'm not sure, Tom. So I avoided that because I felt unsure about using that language. Because the access areas are subsets of the mortality closures. And would we even continue to call them mortality closures? It seemed best to avoid it and just say,
well,
that for whatever is defined as a spawning closure, that the exemption would exist. That was my intent.
Okay.
Terry.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to Jimmy's point about the fish being spawned out by April 1st. They're spawning now, and they're spawning in big numbers. We were out last week. Even the 16-inch fish that for some reason people are calling juvenile fish, but they're sexually mature fish, are full of spawn. So, I mean, right now the haddock are in full bloom. So, I mean, we still got another month and a half left of the closure. So I think April 15th is more an appropriate date anyhow.
Doug.
So to this motion, my question, I assume this is an amendment to that particular motion, so it's not a separate option at all. Go ahead.
That would be correct. This is an amendment to the motion on the board.
Because before I vote for this, I'd like to. I appreciate the input that you have, being someone who represents some of the people in the scallop gear, scallop industry. Excuse me. I would like to have that analyzed before I agree to put that in as a preferred alternative. That's the only objection I'd have to that. But and while I have the mic, I can. I had a question for Tom, just sort of related to the no action alternative. We had this issue. This he described to us the effects of us choosing certain options on the no action spawning alternative in the Gulf of Maine. Does that apply here if we choose for Georgia's Bank and Great South Channel, Southern New England, any alternative but no action in the habitat management? Does that change what the no action is here in the spawning?
Tom?
I wasn't thinking. My answer, I think, is yes, but you caught me a little by surprise with that question. I think the same thing applies. I will point out that this has a different suite of alternatives than we did in the Gulf of Maine. Alternative 2 is a prime example where it uses the closed areas now but identifies a time period and a specific time period and clearly identifies them as a spawning closure. It's also a little more difficult to give you a firm answer here, I think, because unlike in the Gulf of Maine where you made a preferred alternative choice on the western Gulf of Maine closed area, that you haven't done that on Georgia's Bank yet. So I'm not quite sure which way we're headed in this area.
That's my caveat. If we were to choose at final decision something other than the no-action alternative and the two habitat management sections here that apply to that. That's something I'd like to have clarified before we make final decisions on this.
Before final decision today or final decision in September?
September.
Okay, thanks.
Phew. Tom and then John.
So, I just want to remind the council that we recently took an action where we groundfish action, I think framework 48, where we modified the access to the access area on Georgia's Bank. And, you know, there's some analyses in that document that I'm not sure really comport well with some of the statements that have been made today about the time of spawning. We relied on a research program done by the scallop industry, for example, and I think if you look at the results in that, it showed yellowtail flounder spawning in closed area 2 tended to be closer to the May-June time frame in terms of spawning condition of the fish that were detected in there. So we're going to have to sort all that out, and we'll analyze it if it's not already analyzed in the document, which it probably is.
John.
I think I'm going to ask Jim if he Weinberg if he wants to weigh in on this. But before that, on the time of spawning, heard testimony from members of the industry about the importance of these 2 weeks for market conditions, and I'm not sure that's important, but I don't know that's a driver on this amendment. And we've also heard how superior Canada seems to be in so many things, but I think their spawning closure is until June 1st. So that may be instructive, too. So the timing on this, everyone is in favor of spawning. And so I guess the question is, what is the science? The industry, Terry, you have said they're done by, you know, in the next week or two. So getting a handle on that, the next month or so, getting a handle on the timing is really critical on this. We want to get it right. We don't want to get it wrong. And so I don't know if you know, and I'm not sure without that information you can send something out that's preferred or that I could vote for something, not knowing that. But, Jim, can you shed any light on the timing of this?
Well, the short answer is not at this time.
Great.
I'm sorry. But that doesn't mean that the information isn't out there somewhere. And I think that I would have to contact people at the Science Center to find out what's in the documents related to this or recent observations. But I'm not prepared to answer it at this time.
Terry.
Yeah, what I said, John, was I was out over Valentine's. They were full of spawn. We were in the western part of Georges at that time. Cod and haddock were spawning all the way. So that's February 15th. And that gives us another 6 weeks. And it's been 2 weeks, so that's 8 weeks out. So that I think that they'll be done first, second week of April by my estimation. And I'm a scientist.
Doug.
Could I ask the PDT what the information is we use to base those 3 months as a spawning closure? Does that corroborate what Terry's saying?
I think it was information was the basis for the month and the spawning closure.
For the alternatives, the months for the alternatives, is the question. The spawning area closures and alternatives 2 and 3, the time frame was set at February, March, and April, and we must have, I assume we used some kind of information to base those 3 months, the timing.
Actually, it reverts back to the original spawning closure before they were determined to be changed to year-round closures, and that came from some analysis done back in the ICES days, and it also relates to marketability of spawning fish quite some time ago, that analysis done, so it's kind of traditional.
That answers my question.
Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this conversation reveals that before we start tinkering with the timing of spawning closures, we should figure out what they are, and we don't have a clear handle on what the current science is. There are references, I've read them into the record before, regarding the motion to amend. I don't have them in front of me, but I've mentioned them at committee meetings, I think last May, that there's research showing that dredging and mobile bottom tending gear do break up spawning congregations. And so I'm opposed to the motion to amend. I don't think it's scientifically justified. And I'm opposed to alternative 2B also. I think status quo is a better way to go.
Tom.
Thanks. Could we look at the list? This is these spawning measures are in place, as I understand it, for all gears capable of catching groundfish. I guess my question is, does that include midwater trawl herring boats? And would the midwater boats then be able, if not, be able to access these areas during the identified groundfish spawning times?
Tom.
So if you look on page 104 of the document, while it's generally true that it's closed to commercial fishing gears capable of catching groundfish, there are a number of exemptions listed. I'm actually in the wrong spot. I was looking at should be
it's
on page 105. But anyway, it says the same thing. It lists the exempted gears, and it also lists vessels participating in the midwater trawl exempted fishery, vessels participating in the cultivator shoals or raised foot rope whiting fishery.
Sorry, just to be clear, so those vessels are not allowed? They are excluded from spawning areas?
No, I think they're allowed in.
Okay. Well, could we make that issue, rather than add an alternative or anything, I think we should definitely make that issue prominent as we identify what is and isn't going to be taking place in groundfish spawning areas as we go out to public comment. I think some people would want to know if midwater trawl and pair trawl herring boats are able to access these areas during times that haddock are spawning.
Okay.
further comments on the motion to amend? Seeing none, those who support the motion to amend, please indicate so. And those opposed? The motion fails, 7-8. We're back to the main motion. Tom? Oh. So then we need to count again. 7-8-1, okay. Okay, we're back to the main motion. Mary Beth?
Well, I mean, clearly my amendment failed, so I just to point out to people the complication there. If scallop vessels are excluded during February, March, and April, and then excluded during all of September and part of August, well, it's like August 15th to November 1st, and there's an expectation from this council that then the scallop industry is going to come up with an agreement to not fish there during times when there's a lot of lobster activity, this is going to complicate it. It's going to make it very difficult to come up with an agreement with that other industry, and it's going to exclude the vessels for long periods of time, and it certainly is going to make access area management much more difficult to minimize bycatch, and it's just really, it's not a good thing. So,
any final comments to the motion on the board? Seeing none, those who support the motion on the board, please indicate so. Those opposed? And those abstaining? That's right. We're missing two votes. Who didn't vote? Or who didn't count right, I guess is probably more like it. Okay. Those who support the motion, please indicate so. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay. All right. Those opposed? And those? And one abstention. Two abstentions. The motion carries 10-4-2. Okay. Is there any further business with spawning? Mary Beth.
Just a question, Mr. Chairman. Relative to that 2014 priority for the Groundfish Committee to look at spawning issues for groundfish, what's the task there? I mean, if we're sending this out to a public hearing, I just don't recall how this fits into the workload for groundfish and how it impacts this decision. And I'm wondering if somebody could let me know.
Andy.
Actually, if we could, we had a question on the previous motion. If we could take that up first before we get into impact issues. We wanted to verify that the seasonal change in this alternative also applied to other non-preferred alternatives, so we're not just creating a second alternative. Is there consensus on that, or yes or no?
So we're editing the alternatives in the document to have this season rather than the stated season.
Everybody clear? What questions being asked?
So all the seasons will end April 15th rather than April 30th.
Yes.
Is there an objection to that? Okay. Another question, Andy?
No, this was to Mary Beth's question.
That was your question?
No. With respect to priorities, I think this came out back in, and Andy and Michelle may want to weigh in here. The last spring, while the closed area technical team was working on identifying a number of different spawning alternatives, particularly in the Gulf of Maine area, and the council decided to take out most of those, in fact, maybe all of those new spawning alternatives and have them identified or reviewed and have the spawning area issue forwarded to the ground fish committee to deal with modifying those spawn enclosures. So the document was left with just a few of the spawn enclosure alternatives that were that surfaced during the development of this document because they wanted them referred to the ground fish committee. We've added that as a priority for this year, and that's intended to be worked on as part of Framework 52, if I got the number right, which they're starting to work on now.
Mayor Beth.
So if I could just add one follow-up. I mean, some of us are going to a climate change workshop in a few weeks, and I think that one thing about spawning activity is it's environmentally driven, and I really believe that these, you know, hard months of this and, you know, between this and that and trying to capture spawning activity is going to work sometimes and not work other times. And when I heard a reference to the data that's underlying this, it sounds quite old to me. It really does make you wonder if this is the right thing. So I just think that the Groundfish Committee, when they take it up, which I think is the best place to have the discussion, should think about adaptive management. When we manage spawning measures in the Gulf of Maine, as you know, Mr. Chairman, the state of Maine and the state of Massachusetts both have significant sampling programs, and the protocols for those going into place are based on the condition of the fish. Now, that's ideal. It's kind of, you know, somewhat labor-intensive on an ongoing basis. But if we're going to see, you know, rapid environmental change in the Gulf of Maine and Georges Bank, having these, you know, months and things set in stone, and it may not be the best way to go forward. It may be what we need to do today, but I think we need to recognize that this is a changing environment, and we should try to develop measures that are more adaptive.
Terry.
Yeah, I think that is the thing to do today, but we agreed under the to put it back to the Groundfish Committee and let them work on it. But I think there's a lot of moving parts here. So I think we need to decide what areas are going to be closed in the habitat amendment before we decide what spawning areas they are. Because that's what was confusing us before, because there were so many areas moving around that, I mean, you couldn't wrap your head around any of the paperwork for the prepping for the meeting. And so, you know, I think once the habitat amendment gets straightened out and it's decided the areas that we're going to, then that's the time to move ahead with spawning and to get the right areas at the right time. And I agree that we are in a changing time with the spawning areas and stuff. So I think spawning is fluid. I mean, it might be June this year, but it might be July next year. You know what I mean? Whatever.
Jim?
Yeah, thank you. After John Bullard asked me the question, I spoke to Paul Rago, who's the chief of our population dynamics branch, and he told me that it would be very difficult with the data that we have to get down to that fine scale of shaving off a couple of weeks to determine when a spawning season ends. And I think from coming back into the room, the discussion that you've just had is reasonable. Like Mary Beth said, these things can be environmentally driven. There can be annual variation and so forth. And an approach of sampling year by year would probably be needed to focus on individual species to know what's going on in that season. So given the survey data that we have, I don't think they would be adequate to get down to this scale of defining the temporal timing of spawning and when it ends.
Doug.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the previous vote, one of my concern with the motion that Mary Beth made was that it was the option and the only option that was going to go into the preferred alternative. And I'm certainly willing to entertain an option here, where a sub option where scallop dredges would be listed as an exempted. As being exempted from the spawning, both spawning alternatives, alternatives 2 and 3. So I'd like to make a motion to that effect, that motion that a sub-option under alternatives for any of the spawning alternatives would have scarlet dredges be listed as an exempted, as exempted from the spawning alternative.
Seconded by Laura. Drew.
Thank you. Drew Minkiewicz, Fisher Survival Fund. We support this as being an option in the document. While we've been loath to add options into the document, this issue of spawning and who is exempt and not exempt, this is the first time that the council or a committee, to my knowledge, has actually directly discussed or made motions on this topic. This has largely been staff-driven to this point. So this is your first opportunity, really, to address this topic. So this is a time where you can make modifications to what the staff have proposed. So this is absolutely appropriate at this time to make this kind of option. Let's analyze it. And, you know, as Mary Beth pointed out before, if this isn't an option in there, you really have an absurd outcome of when scallopers are or are not allowed into these areas. And so I think we need to make this a real option. And then we'll analyze it, we'll discuss it, and, you know, we'll hopefully see you in September for a final action on it.
What year, Drew? Other comments from the audience? Eric.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Eric Hansen, longtime scalloper. I'd like to speak in favor of the motion. Fishing on the edge, like I have for many years, noticed that a lot of the dragons just follow the scallopers. Now we're actually feeding them. So I don't think we're disturbing them if they're following us. So I don't see that argument at all. And actually, we might be helping to sustain them. So I just want to make that point. Thank you.
Anyone else? Back to the council. PK.
Yeah, I like this motion that Doug put up. I didn't vote for the last motion because of the same reasons that Doug talked about. So I like it better in a motion like this.
David.
Yeah, it was mentioned that if we didn't have this, it would make it extremely difficult for the scallopers to work out an agreement with the lobster fishery. So with this in place as an option, if indeed we do eventually adopt it, it might make it easier then for that agreement to be worked out. It's extremely important. It really needs to be worked out quickly, as opposed to months down the road. So I support the motion.
Anybody else? Matt.
I'm just going to repeat my objection to the previous motion. We've got Science Dean et al. 2012 shows that mobile bottom tending gear does disrupt spawning congregations, and for that reason, I will be opposing this.
Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the maker of the motion. I certainly do appreciate it. I had contemplated this but thought that it might be called out of order since I failed on the previous motion. It was so similar. So I support the motion, and I thank the maker.
Anybody else? Okay. So, Tom.
I'm just checking here. Do you have a concept of how you would analyze this? I can't hear you.
We were just trying to have that discussion.
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to figure out whether what we've just done has doubled the number of spawning options in the document, or if there's some way we can just somehow expand the analysis so that we're not actually doubling the number of alternatives.
So I think...
This says any spawning alternative, not just the spawning alternatives on George's Bank, for starters.
Right. I mean, I think also getting to what Tom Dempsey said earlier, it might be possible just to sort of parse the effort or expected effort in these areas by gear type to be able to evaluate sort of how much activity you'd really be sort of excluding or preventing with these spawn enclosures. And do it all by gear so you can sort of look at the impacts by gear. But I don't know. I mean, especially for these areas, it's a little tricky because there isn't, you know, currently a lot of fishing effort in there. So we're already sort of guessing at what the, you know, relative effort would be by different gears.
The other question I have is whether the motion really is intended to apply to all spawning alternatives or just the ones on George's Bank. You've got one or two spawning alternatives in the Gulf of Maine.
At this point, my original intent of the motion was just to apply to the spawning alternatives on George's Bank because we've already addressed the ones up on the...
Could you slide that in there, please? Okay. Those support the motion on the board, please indicate so. And those opposed? The motion carries 12-4. Is there any further business on spawning areas? And okay, we're on the home stretch here, Michelle.
This remote control is starting to hate me. All right, so there's just a couple other quick things to cover, hopefully quick. We talked about dedicated habitat research areas yesterday, and I touched on the fact that there is one proposal on George's Bank, and then we sort of said, let's talk about that tomorrow. So in the southern part of closed area 2, there's this DHRA proposed as a mobile bottom tending gear closure. It's been a habitat closure to mobile bottom tending gear for a number of years, and so if this DHRA were designated, that would continue, presumably based on the council's discussion yesterday that the sunset provision would apply to that area. So if research is ongoing or sort of imminently pending, it would continue to exist. And if no research is really being actively done or is active, you know, proposed to happen in the near future, the area could be removed. So there's the area. It's just the southern part of closed area 1. Andy can get it up too. Or not. Okay, so there's the area. You all know where the southern part of closed area 1 is anyhow. So in terms of the impacts, generally we expect, you know, some slight positive benefits of this designation, and that really relates to the information that would be gained and how that would sort of feed into management over the longer term and improve management. Some of the work that's already been done here and that's been discussed here relates to sort of scallop seed and how those small animals are distributed with respect to habitat type. So there's sort of, you know, really fine scale questions to look at regarding productivity of that resource with respect to habitat type. In general, the sort of potential displacement of effort, I mean, obviously this is currently an area that's closed to many types of fishing. So forecasting displaced effort kind of relies on an inference based on adjacent areas. But in a review of observed trips that sort of are around the you know, southern, western, and eastern boundaries of this area, there's generally not a lot of effort. So it seems that this exact part of George's Bank really isn't a center of fishing effort. And then the scallop PDT looked at long and short-term scallop yields in these areas, and the scallops really are more to the north in the current access area and in sort of the southern part of the northern closed area 1 habitat closure. So it seems like the scallop resource in this area is really small. So it's not currently open to that gear type, but even if it were, there probably wouldn't be a lot of effort there. So in terms of potential displacement, especially for scallops, it seems that that there wouldn't be some significant negative economic impacts. Yeah, so that's basically all I have on that.
Questions for Michelle? Does the council wish to designate this as a preferred alternative? Matt?
I would make a motion that we adopt alternative 4 as a preferred alternative for DHRA, Georgia Spring.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dave Preble. Comments from the audience? Ron?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smolowitz. I'm aware that the Kennemesset Farm Foundation has an RSA project in 2013 in conjunction with SMAST, and they moved over 300,000 scallop seed into that area, have an extensive before monitoring of the sediment, and we have a continual monitoring program. And we also have, with Dr. Chen at SMAST, doing a lot of oceanography related to that spot and 4 additional spots outside of that area. The key thing is that this particular area is in the midst of major scallop grounds but seldom gets scallops, so we're trying to understand the factors that affect larval recruitment, which is our major issue. So the area is actively under a research program now, and we submitted for 2014 to continue the research. I do have one question, maybe to the regional office. It's been very difficult to do research in habitat-closed areas, independent of the research areas. And I'm just wondering, is that still going to be the case? For example, if the northern edge areas, whatever area gets chose, or the channel, once they're closed, are we going to be prevented from doing surveys in those areas, for example, which is it's been the case in the past?
I'll try to answer that. I know in the past if it's an area that's only closed as a habitat management area, we wouldn't necessarily say you can't do research there, but there would have to be an explanation or a rationale as to why you couldn't do it somewhere else just as easily. But if you pass that rationale, then I think there are some that we've approved.
Okay, I'm just remembering how tough it was for VIMS to do the scallop survey in the northern edge. So that's why I was curious. Thank you.
Any other comments from the audience? Maggie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The industry proposal for DHRAs was for no action alternative in the Georges Bank area, and I'll just speak to the concerns of Associated Fisheries of Maine about the DHRAs in general, and that is that, I mean, I get the concept of, you know, having these areas where you're going to do research, but the fact is that there's no plan, there's no money. Nobody really has a plan to do research in this particular area. We supported the area on Stellwagen because there was a plan that had the industry had worked out an agreement with the researchers, at least the commercial industry had, and then they had a plan, and you know, presumably they have some money to deal with that. So there's no plan here. We're just saying this is a substantial portion of closed area 1, which, you know, 20 years ago was a really good place to go fishing. And we're just saying that it's going to be closed on day 1 to mobile gear. And if someone comes along with a plan, you know, they can do some research. But we don't really know that anybody's going to do that. So I just, there has to be a better process for, I mean, maybe you can designate it as a DHRA, but you don't close it until someone actually comes forward with a plan and that you approve that plan and you say that that plan actually makes sense to do in that area. And they document that they have the money to do it. You know how long it's going to take. You know what they want to try to accomplish. That would make sense. But to just say closed on day 1, and, you know, whenever you guys feel like coming up with a plan to do something in there, let us know. And they go to the regional administrator and, you know, he or she approves that plan. So this is, we can't support this without some understanding of what exactly is going to happen there, how long it's going to take to determine the goals and objectives of that plan, and that there's money to actually do the research. Thank you.
Vito. You know.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Northeast Seafood Coalition was concerned also with having a DHRA without a plan. There's no, I think, having something that showed what the reference areas are and the treatments in the non-reference areas would be important, because if we're trying to study the impacts of fishing in this area where the entire experiment would happen, it would be good to know, you know, where is fixed gear going to fish? Where would trawl gear fish? Where would scallop dredges be? And then where's the reference area? All that needs to be defined. And so one of the things that we put in there is that the sunset provision would apply to all DHRAs, regardless whether the council adopts this one in the future, that if nothing comes up that's of any value, then it goes away. So right now, where there isn't a comprehensive plan, the treatments aren't delineated, and neither is the reference area, we're basically saying it's not ready to be approved. So to pick it as a preferred at this point with no plan, we thought was premature, and that's why we oppose having a DHRA just delineated for the sake of delineating it without any, you know, plan attached to it.
Anybody else? Back to the council. Ellen.
I'd like to make a friendly amendment to this, and that is that alternative 5 be added as a sunset provision.
Feeling friendly? You're all wore down, huh?
Thank you.
You okay with that, David?
Yeah, it doesn't matter because there's a piece of information that hasn't been introduced here yet. But it should have. I agree, it should have the sunset provision. But there is something else here that's going on that is going to affect us. But we can go ahead and do this.
Well, you got the mic.
No.
Terry.
So I had a question. I thought I just heard Ron say he had a plan and he was doing research there now.
He actually is. That's correct.
So. There is something going on there now.
Tom.
I'm trying to open up yesterday's motions, but I'm having trouble. Didn't we approve alternative 5 yesterday?
Yes, we did.
Dave.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad Tom mentioned that because I had forgotten that. So alternative 5 is on this already. That's my understanding. But first of all, I agree completely with Vito that we and with Maggie that we need to have comprehensive plans. There's no question about that. I mentioned that once before. DHRAs are entirely too ad hoc right now, but we had to stop someplace. And I would like to see this grow into something that is far more useful than what we see right now. But as far as this particular DHRA is concerned, there is research ongoing in there at this time, and it's being funded under the Scallop Research Set-Aside Program. And it's valuable research. It's going to be continuing. And for that reason, then it's entirely appropriate to designate this as a DHRA. And the sunset provision applies, so when Ron's research ends, at whatever time that is, then the sunset provision would keep us from being locked in with something that sits here forever with no value.
David.
When we discussed the DHRA for the Stellwagen Bank area, we didn't note what the Stellwagen Bank staff already understand, and that is enforcement. When you have a dedicated habitat research area, you need to have some enforcement. You need to make sure that whatever research is done within the area isn't somehow interfered with by fishing activity within the area. They have apparently an enforcement presence in their office in Scituate. I think it's a NOAA law enforcement officer who is somehow engaged in active enforcement of the Stellwagen Bank sanctuary. So they're confident that they can get adequate enforcement of whatever they do within the sanctuary relative to the reference area and the DHRA. But in this particular case, I'm not sure. It's certainly an idea that has merit, but if we were to adopt this as preferred and eventually adopt it at the public hearing, is this a dedicated habitat research area that actually would have any enforcement at all? Would this require a steady Coast Guard presence, which isn't going to happen? So I would hate to deceive ourselves and the public by thinking that we're actually going to have something that would be monitored and enforced so that whatever research is done isn't compromised. Why exclude commercial fishing operations from that particular area by making it a DHRA when there's a very low likelihood, maybe no enforcement presence? So I hesitate to call it a preferred until I can get some confirmation, some better understanding as to whether or not this has any chance of being effective. Will it be enforced?
I think that argument can be applied to all the DHRAs. Mary Beth.
Right, but this one in particular, since it's way offshore, and Coast Guard has a lot of burdens on it already, and I don't think they're going to give any priority to this in light of everything else they have to do.
Tom.
Just to follow up on this, I'm not sure, and someone could correct me from the Enforcement Committee, but I thought we had a discussion about habitat management area enforcement. And I, from my standpoint, I don't think enforcement on this area would be any different or more complicated than any other area that we've contemplated in this amendment. And we have contemplated measures, including measures that are still in the document that are quite a bit smaller than this. So I assume that at some point we had an enforcement conversation. My recollection was that enforcement basically said, we can do that.
Terry or Frank?
Well, I wasn't the chair at that point, but, I mean, I'm sure for the Coast Guard, there's a few of them in the audience. I mean, I'm sure that they would be more than willing to enforce a DHRA or a closed area. I don't see why it's any different than what we have for closed areas. I don't see it any different than that.
Okay. Anybody else? Seeing none, those who support the motion on the board, please indicate so. Those opposed? The motion passes 13-3. Michelle, is there anything else?
So the sort of final element of the amendment that we haven't yet talked about this meeting is framework adjustments and monitoring. I'm going to sort of hopefully tag team with Andy on this discussion because it's something he worked on quite a bit with members of the closed area tech team. So basically right now we have sort of an ad hoc approach to adjusting area management, areas and restrictions and strategy in terms of the timing of that and sort of the general approach to that. And something we sort of discovered along the way, especially with regards to some of the groundfish data as we were trying to evaluate areas and develop new areas, is that there's really some sort of fine scale data, in particular areas that we really wished we had available to us, specific times of year that we really wished were available. And in some ways it was really challenging to sort of evaluate the costs and benefits of area closures given on a really fine scale, given some of the data we had. So what was talked about, and this came out of sort of a council request as well, was, you know, being a little bit more structured about how this might go in the future. So probably the simplest part is actually that we talked about in the Habitat, this is something the Habitat Committee had discussed and had added to the materials over the years, was making these habitat management areas and measures within them frameworkable. So that's some sort of specific language that this amendment proposes, including in the regulations, that you could make these kind of adjustments within a framework. I don't know if that would have to be an omnibus framework. And then other parts of this action alternative would be to sort of take a more sort of planned approach to revising area management. There's kind of two elements to that. The first would be sort of identifying a time certain interval at which the council would sort of approach this. And the idea there is that would help, you know, for long-term planning, it would help stakeholders kind of understand what to expect in terms of when would these issues be taken up again. And then the other element to that is identifying as part of the amendment, and this would be in the amendment document. I don't think it would be something that would go into the regulations anywhere, but just, you know, what data would be really helpful to this process that are data that we're not gathering right now. And so those are all listed under the action alternative in Volume 3 of the EIS. In terms of, you know, when to do this sort of periodic update, the closed area technical team and the PDT talked about this, and we sort of talked about how long you would expect it to take to see benefits of these areas. And, you know, that's kind of based on the life history and the lifespan of some of these animals and when you would expect to see a measurable effect. So we sort of threw 10 years intervals out as a straw man. Obviously, the council can feel free to adjust that in terms of a plan. You know, certainly the council could choose in a future action to take it up more quickly, but I think the idea with identifying the action alternative as preferred would be at least to be sort of signaling that the intent would be to take this approach and also to sort of make every, you know, the universe of people collecting data and who are stakeholders in this process aware of sort of the additional data that would be required. And so generally, you know, these alternatives come out with, you know, sort of, it's hard to, you know, really come up with specific positive or negative impacts. But, you know, the thinking is that, you know, because it allows for better planning and, you know, provides some more transparency and hopefully generates some additional data because specific data needs are being identified, that there would be positive benefits for the resource and for sort of the community of people involved in management in terms of understanding, you know, sort of what to expect and how to be involved. So, you know, I think probably as we proceed through the next few months and get some comments during the hearings, we maybe can certainly refine some of the language in these sections. But really, I guess for today, the point, if the council wants to identify a preferred alternative, would be, you know, generally, do we want to stick with a more ad hoc approach, or generally is the sort of a more planned approach the way that the council would wish to go?
Questions for Michelle? Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could changes to the definition of EFH that's contained in Volume 2 potentially be frameworked going forward? Thank you.
You know, that's not something we've actually specifically talked about, is the EFH definitions. There is an element of the EFH regulations that sort of identifies already a five-year review for EFH regulations, which I'm a little bit afraid is going to start as soon as the final rule is published on this amendment.
Starting 5 years ago.
Yeah. We haven't really talked about that being that the Habitat Committee discussion centered around updating the measures and the habitat management adverse effects minimization areas. But, you know, certainly.
Ellen.
Thank you, Michelle. This is what I was talking about this morning. I
We have had closed areas for I can't even remember how long, and I know that industry has asked over and over again that they be reviewed. It's been extremely difficult over the years to have get exemptions for universities and industry to do research within many of the closed areas, and it has gotten easier over the past few years, but it's still not a real timely event. And so if you have a spawning event that you need to look at quickly, it's not something that's going to happen in this year. So I think this is one of the most critical things in the entire document, because closing areas without adaptive management, without being able to tweak them and make sure that they're working, is absolutely useless. So I would put up a motion that sorry, I didn't send you anything, Karen, that we that the council adopt the framework adjustments and monitoring alternative 2 with the 10-year minimum, maximum 10-year intervals for management measures, or
as our preferred alternative.
Thank you.
Seconded by David Pierce. Dave Frula.
Thank you, David Frula, for the Fisheries Survival Fund. Some ability to do adaptive management is really important in these habitat measures. I don't know if I may even be getting my numbers wrong, but Scallop Amendment 10 came in and then Groundfish Amendment 13 came in, and the idea was that there was a little bit different closures in closed area 1 between these two documents, and the council fully intended and passed a motion to adjust by framework the scallop closure to conform to the groundfish closure. A federal judge in Washington said that if you put a measure in by amendment, you need to change it by amendment or take it out by amendment. So that's why for the past, 10 years, we haven't been able to adjust closed area 1. So that is the reason why some ability to framework adaptive management is a very good thing. Thank you.
Gene? Then Peter?
Yeah, we actually don't interpret it quite that strictly, David, that court order. At that time, the scallop plan did not have EFH as a frameworkable measure. It did not contemplate it as a frameworkable measure. And since then, we have put in to the scallop plan, groundfish plan, that you can framework EFHs. Now, and that was a fact that was not before the judge at that time, that if there's a specific provision for allowing an EFH to be frameworked, you know, with some preliminary research and or analysis that occurs in the amendment that allows that, that can be done through EFH.
Peter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Peter Shelley, Conservation Law Foundation. We're sympathetic to the issue that is underlying this motion. And, of course, with adaptive management, it might be closing additional areas or changing the management measures within a closed area in addition to opening them. I think there has been a failure to develop a process by which the purposes of some of the management actions we take can be revisited with sufficient regularity to make them as effective as they could be. Having said that, we're very concerned about the process by which this is done. Again, this is a public resource, and many of these measures are measures that as we understand the law, have to be included in fishery management plans. That is, they have to be done by amendment Frameworks in the universe of management options available to the council and the service are intended to be used to make minor adjustments to an underlying fishery management plan. And some of the case law that we've looked at suggests that they're intended to change framework management plan management measures according to specifications that have already been laid out in the underlying fishery management plan. So the public has already seen the basis on which adjustments would happen, has participated, has agreed, disagreed, whatever, but it has been vetted through the fishery management planning process, not through an abbreviated framework process. So when we're talking about 10-year intervals, it's hard for me to believe that we're not talking about at least an amendment as opposed to a framework measure. Maybe it would take 10 years before we thought of a frameworkable thing to do, but I doubt it. I mean, 10 years, we ought to be able to see some real changes one way or the other in some of these closed areas and whether they're working. So I think as this goes forward, the documents really have to lay out with some discipline the specifications under which different management measures associated with these closed areas would be adjusted through the framework process. We're likely to get some additional court guidance on the Framework 48 action because that was the basis of our challenge there. The reason I say that additional discipline is required is just having sat in the audience over the last 2 days and listening to the degree of variation even among the council members and thinking about the specifications that were being used to actually come up with the alternatives, let alone what specifications you would use to adjust those on a framework basis, is quite uncertain, I would suggest, at this point. So we support the framework process. We think it's a very important one. We absolutely support the goals that the motion is trying to advance. I'm just suggesting that there's a difference between a framework and an amendment, and it would be important to the public, both the fishing community, the conservation community, everyone who cares about this resource, that actions that have significant impacts changing any of these management measures are done through a proper process, not through an abbreviated framework process. Thank you.
Anybody else? Seeing none, back to the council. Oh, Dave, sorry. Welcome back.
Thank you. David Gaethel, Fish and Vessel Island, Diane, former 9-year inmate on the Habitat Committee. I'd like to speak in support of the motion. I'm not a lawyer. I don't claim to play one on TV or anything else, and I don't know whether it should be a framework or an amendment, but one of the things that has hindered the Habitat Amendment from day one has been the fact that there has been no real research plan ever laid out for the previous closed areas. Ad hoc means nothing gets done. There has to be a structured plan so that these things are monitored and they can be adapted as necessary. Otherwise, 10 years from now, you'll be sitting here in the same place we were 10 years ago. What are we going to do? I don't know. We don't have any hard information. So I think it's important to lay this out now as part of this amendment, how to gather the information, what information will be used, how to monitor these things so that you can change them. Because one thing's for sure, from what I've seen with the way things are changing in the ocean, 10 years from now, a lot of these may be irrelevant, and you may want them someplace else. Thank you.
Erica.
Thank you. Erica Fuller, Earth Justice. Can you just clarify for me again the 10-year review, even though the regulation suggests 5 years?
Michelle?
So I think we were making a distinction between 10-year review of sort of overall spatial management and strategies to minimize effects on EFH as compared to 5-year review of the EFH designations themselves. I don't know if that comports with what the regional office would understand is appropriate.
Yeah, that's part of it. There was considerable discussion in the technical team meetings about the time needed to have changes that were measurable and that we were actionable once we measured them. And the technical team felt that 5 years would be insufficient to collect sufficient information and recognize a change in the conditions to warrant a change in the a review. So that's why we settled on a 10-year interval, which is a little bit different than the ambiguity introduced by a maximum of 10 years in the motion, because the maximum implies that it could or should be done much earlier, and we were concerned with that trade-off in terms of expediency versus a measurable change.
Can I just have one follow-up question? Are you aware how other councils do this?
Somewhat. I've had some discussions with some researchers out in California about how they handle their MPAs and how they evaluate them. There are some differences, you know, by region. So we felt that given our set of conditions and what we're dealing with, the 10-year time frame was an appropriate one to be able to measure changes in habitat conditions, and that would lead us to possibly, you know, changing those through a framework adjustment.
Thank you for the clarification.
Anybody else? Back to the council. Doug.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I certainly support this concept, but I am concerned about the standard practice of not having public hearings between a framework. I think any kind of changes to spatial management, I think, has to be vetted publicly. Now, as I understand from previous conversations we've had, there's nothing that prevents a council in a framework action from going out to public hearing. And I will hope that the future council here would be responsible enough to do that. The only thing that, as I said, in an amendment, you do have to go out to public hearing, but of course the trade-off there is the timing. And clearly we've been 10 years at this, and I don't want to have it be another 10 years to make changes. So I'm going to support this motion and hope that the future councils will be responsible enough to take this out to public hearing.
Without going out on a limb, I couldn't imagine a future council not, you know, given the level of scrutiny that we've had over the last number of years. Terry.
I'm going to pass.
Anybody else? Alan.
Just real quickly, I think that was on my list, and I didn't say anything about it, Doug. I think that if this goes through to our final decision, that I would be quite willing to put a stipulation in that before any changes occur, that the changes go out to public hearing so we can codify it. Even though it's not required, I think that we could put it in the framework.
What do you say we ask the public to get what they think? Gene.
You know, my previous comments on the framework doesn't mean if you're looking at redoing the whole concept of how you designated habitat areas in 5 years or 10 years, then it's likely that would have to be done by an amendment. If you're just moving a line by, you know, 10 miles, that seems to be appropriate, you know, on the other end of the spectrum as a frameworkable measure. And certainly the council is free to say any changes to EFH cannot be done by framework. You are free to make that recommendation as well.
So my previous intervention about framework ability of EFH measures doesn't mean that no change to EFH would ever have to be done by amendment, but that you can make certain types of adjustments, I think, to EFH through frameworks. And the council, I think, would be able to make that choice at the time any changes are being proposed. Now, we may, as Peter Shelley suggested, get some further clarification of this from the courts in the challenge to Framework 48 that CLF brought. But for now, I think that's where NOAA's position is concerning framework ability of EFHs versus requiring them to be done by amendment. Any concept of an action is potentially not frameworkable if it's something that is totally outside previously contemplated types of changes for an activity or for a measure.
Anything further, Tom?
Yeah, I really would like to hear from the public on this now. I thought this was sort of maybe perhaps more straightforward, but I think we should probably go through, and maybe this is a recommendation for staff, that as we go out to public comments, we sort of ask questions about what we people expect and would want things to be frameworkable or not. I mean, moving a line 10 miles doesn't seem like a lot, but some of these areas, moving 10 miles one way or the other is pretty significant. So, and even if that 10-mile, you know, line was identified as insignificant, is 12, is 15? I mean, some of these things, you know, there's a gradient that would be make for some very tough judgment calls. So I'd like to hear industry and stakeholders on this. So I'll oppose, and let's send it out and see what people have to say. It seems a little bit more complicated than I thought.
Okay. Who else wants to beat it to death? David, Mary Beth?
Call the question, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
A point of clarification, Tom?
Yeah. Trying to do this very quickly. Just because you list something as a framework doesn't mean you have to do it as a framework. And the other thing is I would caution the council against tying your hands too tightly to a particular process. We've heard a lot of discussion about how frustrated we get with our inability to do rapid adaptive management, and yet here we are talking about potentially about tying our hands so that we have to go through a long, lengthy process in order to make a change. So I really think you might want to consider to keep things as flexible as the law allows you to do rather than to tie your hands. You may have a minor change that everybody wants down the road. Do you really want to tie your hands and say, well, we can only do that through an amendment that's now going to take us 8 months to get it through the process? I don't think you want to do that.
Last word, Mayor Beth.
So those were some of my thoughts exactly. And so the way I viewed this is that we're committing ourselves to do this review at least every 10 years in a more comprehensive way, but that it wouldn't prevent us from being adaptive in the interim as needed, particularly in light of the dynamic situation in the region and climate change, which you already mentioned. And relative to the public hearing part of it, I mean, to meet our public hearing requirements under the law, does it mean doing a dog and pony show from New Jersey to the Canadian border every time? I mean, there's lots of ways that which we can accomplish meeting that requirement, and we can have public hearings during a council meeting. Other councils do that. So I think we have continued to try to incorporate public comments in all of our actions, I would hope, and we would do so for this. So unless, I mean, somebody disagrees with me, my interpretation of this motion is that it does not tie our hands, but it is a commitment to a 10-year basis.
Mitch?
Yeah, I think I was a little bit confused about what this 10-year time period refers to. The regulations refer to a complete review of information every 5 years. It seems like you're talking about a review of the information, but every 10 years. And I just want to clarify, and Michelle was making the point earlier, that I think trying to clarify the difference between what is being offered here or not. But I wanted to clarify that the regulations refer to review of information of all the scientific literature and all the provisions in the EFH section. Well, I could read it to you. It says FMP councils and NIMH should periodically review the EFH provisions of FMPs and revise or amend them as warranted based on available information. FMP should outline the procedures the council will follow to review and update EFH information, and the review of information should include but not be limited to evaluating published scientific literature and published unpublished scientific reports, soliciting information from interested parties, and searching for previously unavailable or inaccessible data. Complete review of all EFH information should be conducted as recommended by the Secretary, but at least once every 5 years.
Given that advice, those who support the motion on the board, please indicate so. And those opposed? Motion carries 13-3. Michelle. Not quite yet, Dave. Is there any further business of Jeff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate you giving me a couple of minutes. On behalf of the Mid-Atlantic Council, we'd like to request that public hearing on the omnibus be held in the Mid-Atlantic region. Some point in the future. Slide 9 from the presentation, the excellent presentation, by the way, that Michelle put together, comments on the overlap between the species. So we'd like to have a hearing on the omnibus in our region. And the other issue I wanted to mention is an issue that I raised in December, and that is that there's been a request in our region again to take a look at the EFH boundary designation for winter flounder eggs in southern New Jersey, which is part of Volume 2 of this document. And there are researchers involved in pulling habitat information together. We've talked to Dr. Stevenson and other people. So I just wanted to flag that for the council, that there may be, during the public hearing, a request to consider a modification to winter flounder egg EFH. So I just wanted to put those two issues on the table. Thanks for the opportunity to do that.
Tom.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. This is an issue identified on page 35 of the decision document. It's the issue of the status of the exemption areas. Hopefully we can do this by consensus, but the short story is for some fisheries, particularly small mesh whiting and general category scallops, there's a second set of measures that are keeping them out of some of the areas that perhaps would become open in the habitat omnibus. It's a groundfish issue. Maybe by consensus we could just task request that the groundfish committee discuss this at their next appropriate meeting and how to resolve it. I can talk a little bit more about it if you want, but it's basically outlined on page 35. I just think we've changed them before, and we just need to basically consider whether we want to change them again.
Tom?
I guess the struggle I have here is it's difficult for us to review the status of exemption areas till we know what the final alternatives are. So we recognize that this is something we're going to have to do, but it's not clear to us that we can spin our wheels a lot if we start doing this too soon and then all the areas change. That's my only concern. Plus, we didn't identify it as a priority this year because we were looking ahead, figuring we'll do it after the amendment is approved.
Tom.
Yeah, I think it's worth having a conversation now like we've had for the rotational access areas, because on day one, you know, closed area one could open for limited access fleet, for, you know, for mobile gear, everyone except general category scallops. And I think there are some other issues that are worth talking about. Maybe we decide let's hold off on it, but as long as we can have that conversation at the groundfish committee, we can air out the issues with regards to staff time and just really just discuss the pros and cons of addressing this now.
Can we say at a groundfish committee sometime in the near future? I think the agenda for the next groundfish committee or two is going to be pretty loaded.
Fine.
Okay.
And we've got another issue coming up under the business. Mary Beth.
Excuse me. It just seems like this issue of access for general category scallops could be dealt with in perhaps the next framework if we're going to deal with limited access. Deirdre's indicating that it's a groundfish regulation. I mean, I looked at the list of you know, things that need to be sort of straightened out after the fact here, and it seemed like they should all go to the appropriate species committees. And if they're currently groundfish regulations, we should change that. It's complicated how we manage everything over time. I don't have the right solution to offer at the moment, but I think we have a little time to figure it out.
John.
I just had some summary remarks before adjournment. If I don't know when it's an appropriate time.
Specific to this?
To this and also disaster.
Yes. Can you wait?
Yeah.
If you want to make your comments on this right now, then hold the disaster until other business.
Sure. I just wanted to say a couple of things on what we've done in the last 2 days. On this, and that is, first of all, I wanted to say thank you to staff for helping us get through these 2 days. To Michelle and Andy, wow, what you've done to help us prepare. And on my end, to Maura and Dave, thank you for allowing us to understand so much complex material. I really appreciate it, and to Dave Preble for leading us through it. I come back to a quote from Oliver Wendell Holmes. I would not give a fig for the simplicity on this side of complexity, but I would give my life for the simplicity on the other side of complexity. And I keep looking forward to the simplicity on the other side of complexity and looking forward to the time we get there, because this keeps getting more and more complex, and I'm looking forward to the time when it gets more simple. And I thought maybe, you know, today would be the time when it would start getting more simple. But I don't think so, right, PK? I don't think so. Because I think we added more options, and what we're going to do after today is send it out to the public. And so we're going to receive public comment, and we're going to receive a cumulative effects analysis. And then, I don't know whether it'll be September or whenever, we're going to get all of that stuff back in our laps. And we're going to digest all of that, and then we're going to take some options which are preferred alternatives, and we're going to take some options which weren't preferred alternatives, and we're going to make one recommendation to the service, and then it will be more simple, and then we'll have to make an assessment of, does this meet goals and objectives? And we're getting to the finish line of what will be a major, major achievement of protecting habitat and spawning. And that is an achievement that this council will be very proud of. I don't know, again, whether we completed the denouement, but it is a major piece of work this 2 days, and nobody threw anything at each other. A lot of people put a lot of thought in it. I asked for people to submit comprehensive answers to this. The industry stepped up and did it. I really appreciate it. The NGOs stepped up and submitted really thoughtful
solutions. I appreciate it. Thank you very much for doing that. All of those were very helpful to us, and I want to express appreciation for doing that. Thank you.
Yeah, and I want to reiterate John's accolades for staff. You know, Andy and Michelle, you've done a great, and your team's done a great job, real bang up job. And Dave and Mario too. Thank you, before we take a vote here that Sally McGee thought was never going to happen, Tom's got a few comments to help us manage our expectations. We have pretty successfully toppled that tree over, and we've got a lot of work ahead of us still.
So the first thing I wanted to point out is I'd like to thank, I'll add my thanks to the work, the thanks everybody else said it to the staff, and not just the folks that are here in the room, but there's a whole bunch of staff back at the center, some in our office who've worked on this project who aren't here today, and I'd like to thank them for their efforts too. For those of you who are interested, Andy has posted on the screen, I think, a chart that attempts to show the preferred alternatives that were selected by the council. You might want to take a minute just to look them over so you can see what they look like. I'm going to take a minute to highlight what has been added to the document, and the reason I'm doing that is just to provide a little bit of a lead-in here to what I'm going to say next. We're going to have to do some revisions. We've added allowing shrimp fishing in the north and west of the Jeffries Ledge HMA. That area is not defined yet, so the staff is going to have to define that area, I think, a little more clearly. I'm not sure if there's anything in the record that tells us where to put it. Some changes were made to the central Gulf of Maine with the Cassius Ledge groundfish closure. Some changes to the eastern Gulf of Maine, which might require some changes, particularly to the economic analysis, because it's closed to all vessels capable of catching groundfish as opposed to mobile gear only. I think the big additions have been the alternatives that were added on George's Bank, neither of which has been analyzed at all by the staff. There was a request to expand the analysis of the reduction in swept area through 2011. Some other requests have been added. I'm not going to go into all of those. Some changes to the southern New England groundfish spawning and George's Bank spawning closure alternatives. All this is up to a lead up to say that we had hoped to submit this document in draft form to the agency by the end of March. I know that that's not going to happen now with the addition of these two major alternatives in George's Bank. Our rough guess is that adding those two alternatives is going to take us somewhere around 2 months to adequately analyze those two alternatives and fold them into the document. That's assuming that we are able to get the participation of many of our PDT members who thought they were going to be done by now, and now they're not. So we'll come back to you in April, but I just want to make sure that everybody realizes that the possibility of voting on this document in September appears to be slim at this stage. And we'll know better in April. That's almost 2 months away. We'll know how much work we've accomplished by April, and so we can give you a better evaluation at that point whether we're going to have any chance of making the September date. But my off-the-cuff belief is that we won't make the September date for a final vote. To be clear on what the next steps are, I guess this depends on a motion which may be waiting in the wings, but depending on how that motion is worded, my expectation is that what is going to happen is the staff is going to do the analyses, complete the document, submit it to the Fisheries Service, and we will schedule and go out to public hearings. We are not going to put habitat on the April or June council meeting agendas because I'm not going to give you another chance to add more alternatives. So I guess all that depends on how the final motion of the day is worded, but I think that's going to fit with the way the motion's worded. I just want to make it sure it's clear to everybody that that's the plan. The plan is to do these analyses the way you've asked us to write it up, to go out, submit. Once the agency is comfortable, we can take it to public hearing to take it out to public hearing. So we're not, you know, my recommendation at this point is if you really want this to move forward, not ask us to bring it back again to you sometime down the road until we're ready for the final vote.
Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, this is a moment I've waited for the best part of a decade. And in order to commemorate this auspicious time, I've prepared a speech. Fortunately, John Bullard has already made the speech for me. So, but I do have one final motion. I move to approve the DEIS for Omnibus Essential Fish Habitat Amendment 2, comma, with council modifications and preferred alternatives, comma, for public comment and initial submission to NOAA Fisheries.
Seconded by Terry Alexander. I'm not going to take any comments. Those council members who support the motion on the board, please indicate so. Okay. It's unanimous, 15-0-0. Thank you all. We're on to other business. Terry.
Karen has a motion for me. Did you put that up, Karen? Because my computer's died, so I can't. I'm going to have to read it off the board. I move that the council initiate a narrow and focused framework adjustment to revise the accountability measures for the groundfish sub-ACLs for northern and southern windowpane flounder that would be retroactive for fishing year 2014. The first framework meeting will be the next groundfish committee meeting.
I'll second it.
Seconded by Dave Preville. Comments from the audience? Vito.
Can we do this?
Yep.
It's not on the agenda.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We appreciate you entertaining this motion. We strongly support this. We've mentioned many times that the AM for window pane is for the overall ACL is quite severe and large, and the problem is it's relatively inadequate for preventing an overage the way we have it. And what we'd like to do, industry has some concepts, not stuff to talk about now, but if you initiate a framework, we believe that there can be some pretty expedited solutions and revisions to the AMs that will improve the accountability so that we're not having after-the-fact situations. And so I think it'll be an improvement all around. And you talk about retroactive to 2014. The economic impacts of the window pane AM are going to be in the multi-millions of dollars. We're estimating definitely north of $5 million, and that's back of the envelope for the losses that will happen in that large area, just the winter flounder alone. So there's a lot at stake. It's a very small window pane quota, and this is not a way to get around the AM. This is a way to improve accountability, and we'll show that when we come to the framework meetings.
Other comments from the audience? Jackie.
Jackie O'Dell, Northeast Seafood Coalition. We don't support this motion. Just kidding. So just to follow up on what Vito said, the other point that we make in our letter that I had talked about under public comments was that, you know, we're in a unique situation. Framework 48, we were really, needed to put in AMs for stocks which were non-allocated. I think now we're realizing that they're not going to necessarily do the job, especially in southern New England, which Vito didn't mention, we have, a southern window pane. We have a stock that's rebuilt, and then you have an ACL that goes up the following year that basically accounts for the overage that occurred in the year prior. So I think we just need to really spend some focused time looking at, under a quick, abbreviated framework, looking at these AMs, and that do what they're supposed to do from a biological perspective as well as a legal perspective to stay within our ACLs, as well as, you know, trying to minimize the impacts on the industry. So we strongly support this motion. Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience? Tom.
I just want to make two comments to the council. The first is there's still a little bit of a procedural question with that we're researching about whether the first initial framework meeting can be a committee meeting or not. We're still digging into that. We think it can, but there may be an issue there. The second is that if the council wants to pursue this framework action, one of this year's priorities for groundfish has to be dropped. There's no way that we can continue with a list of priorities that you approved in November for that would be accomplished this year for Framework 52 and add this. We're approaching a relatively critical time where the PDT has to get started working on Framework 52. This is also the period when the Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder empirical benchmark approach is going to start, and our staff was likely going to be, was planning to be involved in the development of that. So this motion is silent. I think there's another motion coming, but I just want to point out that we can't do this unless you drop something from our annual priorities.
Further comments from the council? Seeing none, those support the motion on the board, please indicate so. Okay, those opposed and those abstaining. The motion carries 14-01. Dave. Terry.
Karen has another motion. Yeah. Motion to guide the staff, resources, and any impacts to the council priorities as a result of the groundfish sub-ACL framework, move spawning priority from the annual to multi-year priority category, since the omnibus habitat amendment outcome will largely dictate the direction of spawning measures development. And if I get a second.
Second by Ellen. Terry.
So I talked about this a little bit earlier. I think that we're in a period where I understand spawning is important to all of us. Everybody here thinks spawning is one of our big priorities. But until we have the omnibus in front of us, I think that we're kind of stuck, and the staff needs to start working on that now. And we're the spawning priorities, if that's going to still be a priority, if I'm making sense. I don't know if I am after 2 days of this. But I think Jamie could maybe speak more to that timeline. But this is important for this year, and we need to take care of it this year. So,
comments from the audience? Seeing none, back to the council. David?
Well, I'll support the motion in light of the importance of the previous motion that we passed and the need to drop something. I'll support it, but I do disagree that the omnibus habitat amendment outcome will largely dictate the direction of spawning measures development. I don't think that's true. But, again, priorities, so I'll support it.
Other comments? PK.
Just to Tom, is that going to clear up enough staff time?
I'm going to defer to Jamie here.
Jamie.
So I guess what would be helpful here is certainly moving over something to the multi-year priority list and taking something off the annual list and moving this in. It may clear up some time initially, but I'm not sure that we would be able to make, as the other motion suggested, the April council meeting. For final action. I think that might be pretty difficult given that we would be starting on this next week. So I just want to make people aware of that. Even a June council meeting for final action will be very difficult. We also have other things going on, including developing the
the draft alternatives for approval for the DEIS for Amendment 18 that our PDT has been working on. And we have also been working on electronic monitoring, and I am the staff person on the EM working group. We had we were hoping to provide you at your April council meeting with an electronic monitoring working group draft report. So in order to shift, as suggested by the previous motion, and focus in on these AMs, it's going to shift some other things around, too, including EM and of course, you know, we're going to have to really take a hard look at what we can accomplish and which council meeting we'd be able to accomplish it by. Some of the other things to consider based on the previous motion would be that, you know, if you're looking at an April council meeting, it will be unlikely that you'd have the full suite of the impacts analysis complete that quickly. We haven't even gotten to the alternatives discussion at a committee meeting. You're just talking about today. So there's a lot to do, and I just want people to be realistic about timing. We'll certainly try our best, but other things are going to have to be delayed. And I guess that's a discussion that you'll have to have.
Thank you for helping manage expectations, Jamie. Tom.
Yeah, so the shorter answer, Pete, is that we probably won't really do anything on the spawning closures, even though it's a multi-year priority, until we get done with Framework 52, which will be later this year, or may not do much. And I just want to reiterate what Jamie said. If you're looking at the April council meeting, I think it's right around the 22nd of April or something like that, maybe the 24th. The mailing, I think, is the 12th. So, you know, you've got 5 weeks to get the alternatives, analyze the alternatives, and write them up into a document so that you can review it and then mail it out to people. I won't say that's impossible, but that's going to be a very difficult timeline to meet.
I'll say it's impossible.
Well, James, pretty good.
Are there further comments to the motion on the board? Seeing none, those support the motion on the board, please indicate. Those opposed and those abstaining. The motion carries 14-01. Is there any other business to come before the council?
I want to say one thing on this action.
John?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to take advantage of the fact we got some, still have some people here. As Eileen Sobeck mentioned, it was announced today that disaster funds were appropriated to the six regions where disasters were declared, and $38.2 million was allocated to New England and what? Oh, that's right, 32.8. I'm glad that somebody's still awake here. All right. I wish it were. 32.8. Thank you to New England and New York, and about three to New York, New Jersey for Sandy. And so now the task is how to spend that money wisely to meet the needs of the groundfish industry. And so we've had a number of conversations with members of the industry, with state directors, met with state director designees at lunch. We'll have other meetings. But I just want to say all ideas are welcome. And so whether you're here in the audience, whether you're listening online, ideas are welcome. I know that all the states have already had extensive outreach to the constituents. So if you want to get in touch with me about with your ideas, please do that. If you want to get in touch with your state directors, please do that if you haven't done that already. I just want to encourage people to do that. It's a significant amount of money. Obviously, the need is greater than the resources we have, so the challenge is how do you get the most use out of every dollar. So people with ideas, please send them to me, but I also encourage you to reach out to your state directors as well. Thank you very much.
Is there any further business? Well, thank you, Eileen, for attending our meeting. I hope you enjoy your trip to New England and your weekend at the main forum. This meeting is adjourned.